This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Stellar edition of the, say it with me now, longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. The Hard Travel Fanboys. We are live, well, taped, I suppose you would say, in our studios in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. That voice you heard harmonizing with me, so good, is Nick Duke. And we are here to go off the page as part of Wolverine Month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Nick Duke, how are you on this fine evening, sir?
Well, clearly not as well as you. I get the sense that your healing factor has finally kicked in, and now you're all full of piss and vinegar once more.
It's not 100% recovered. I've had a bit of a lymph node issue this week that is dragging me down a bit. But other than that, I am feeling better than I have been in prior weeks. I feel like hopefully, knock on wood, you know, Lord willing, I'm on the rebound. And yes, my mutant healing factor does not work quite as quickly as Wolverine's or as X-23's or as Sabretooth's or as Lobo's.
Or Deadpool's.
Anyone's, pretty much, or Deadpool's. Mm-hmm. Mine works a little bit like the healing factor of famed inventor and entrepreneur Howard Hughes. Mm. I just lock myself away. I grow my fingernails really long. And I live a long time, albeit in poor health.
That's good.
Hopefully that's the case.
Well, be sure to have that lymph node issue checked out. Those can often be cancerous, so I would hate for that to be.
Oh no, I know. I've already recommitted myself to the concept of dying soon. So that's all right.
Hey, you know what's funny, Greg?
What's that?
You know how sometimes, like when you're in the bathroom and you get a piece of toilet paper stuck to the bottom of your shoe?
That hasn't happened to me in a long time, but sure.
Right. Yeah, you know how that happens. Well, right now, sure. I'm witnessing a first. Right now, right here in our luxurious hard-traveling fanboy studio in Vancouver,
our
Columbia, Canada,
studio. Yes.
Our L-shaped studio, on my half of the L, Herschel the Wonder Dog has somehow got a piece of toilet paper stuck to his penis. So, just thought I'd share. And I'm gonna leave it where it is right now and just see, you know.
You know, if I weren't so lazy, Nick, I'd peek around that L and try to see what you're talking about there, but I'll take your word for it.
It's a little square of toilet paper stuck squarely to the penis.
Interesting. Well, you know, good for the toilet paper, right?
I guess.
Hey, that's just the first of many revelations on this episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, because we've got a huge show for you today. Ladies and gentlemen, later on in this show, an anonymous source has faxed us. That's right. They faxed us to our fax machine here at the Hard Traveling Studios. And if you'd like to fax us, you can fax us at 223-718-9743. And
kids, please get your parents' permission
before faxing. Yes. We actually have Lex Luthor's tax returns.
Oh, God.
On this show.
Oh, man. And I promise you people, that will be our only attempt at topical political humor for the rest of the evening.
It's coming. Later in the show, folks. Just stay tuned. It's coming. In any event,
I wonder what old Axel from The Walking Dead would have made of that segment the other night.
Ah! Oh.
And that's our last attempt at topical political humor. Moving on.
Something that's not topical at all.
No.
It is 2009.
It is in as much as it is Wolverine month, Greg.
It is Wolverine month.
And we just got the last solo Wolverine movie for some time. So it's only appropriate that we're taking a very special look at the first Wolverine solo movie.
That's right. We're going back to 2009, and we're going to take a look at the oft-maligned X-Men Origins Wolverine. And I mean that. I mean that we're going to take a look at it. We're going to invite you, if you so choose, and that is a big if, to watch this film alongside us as we go back and we revisit at least parts of it, of this this movie, which kicked off Wolverine's solo adventures on the big screen. Well, we're going to discuss the casting, the directing, the writing, some of the unique choices that were made during the course of the production. And we're going to, at the end of all of this, let you know where we think it ranks in the X-Men movie pantheon and perhaps even the superhero movie pantheon. We'll let you know. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for this movie. I think some of you may be surprised in a few of our takes on this movie, or maybe not. I don't know. Nick, what do you think?
Yes, have some.
Eloquently stated, as always. Well, with that being said, I'm actually currently firing up my DVD copy of this, because why would anyone ever buy a Blu-ray of it?
Well, actually, if you wanted that cool little Blu-ray set they released a couple years ago that had all the X-Men films in the giant collector's case shaped like Wolverine's claws, you had to buy this one. This was forced upon you. So I think that could be one reason. I think there was also a Sentinel Head set done at some point that had all of them in there. And so,
oh, that would have been neat.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're into the collector's editions, the big box sets, you know, and the inventive packaging or whatever, then that could be one reason to, you know, to pick this one up.
The only package better than that one is Austin Aries' package.
It's a pretty big package. That's true.
That one. Well, Nick, do you have your movie prepared to go?
I am actually not going to be streaming along with you tonight. I'm going to be relying on you to give the. To give the viewer the play-by-play. You see, I had a little bit of trouble locating a copy of this film to watch, and, you know, let's just say I had to resort to means that I'm not proud of.
I love it. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Not all of us had a David Sunday, you know, resource to call upon. Why does David Sunday own a copy of this movie, by the way?
You know, I'm not 100% sure about that, but what I do know is I am very appreciative of the fact that he gave me his copy of it, so because it allowed me to watch it. And prepare for this podcast.
I watched it as well. I didn't say I didn't watch it, Greg.
Well, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I am sitting here at the 002 mark with the 20th Century Fox logo just beginning to appear on my DVD screen here. If you guys would like to follow along with me, I invite you to. Oh my! This is early in the show for this, Nick. What in the world? Let's see. What could this be? Let's see. And then there, North Korea. Patty Duke. Oh, there it is. Ho-Ho Loon, still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
Is Patty Duke any relation to Bill Duke?
Is she any relation to Nick Duke?
No, I can comment on that definitively. As far as I know, anyway. Perhaps there's something my parents aren't telling me.
That could be. But the important thing here, don't lose sight of the fact that Ho-Ho Loon is still employed as of this recording.
Yes.
We'll let you know next week, hopefully, whether he's still employed. We don't know when these things will come in, folks. I mean, who is sending these to us anyway?
Now, here's my question, Greg. Do we have a more – I mean, the ticker, as I look at it right now, which is perfectly positioned – at the corner of the L so that we can both see
right.
It here in the studio. It's kind of big. I mean, are we going to have a mobile version of it to take with us on our pilgrimage in a couple weeks?
You know, I'm hoping that we're going to maybe be able to design an app that maybe we can, you know, maybe those of them out there that are listening to the podcast might be able to download the app and keep up with Ho-Ho Loon's employment status. Granted, one might say that it's a bit of a niche app, but I would argue that it's information that would be valuable to everyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In any event, folks, I am at that 002 mark on X-Men Origins Wolverine, and I invite you to pull it up along with me. Pause the podcast if you need to get ready, because I am going to hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. And there's the 20th Century Fox logo. Well, let's talk a little bit about the build-up for this movie and what led into it. Obviously, Hugh Jackman had been playing Wolverine for quite some time at this point, for about 9 years heading into this movie, 8 years heading into the production of this movie. The first two films were very well received, did great at the box office, good reviews. X-Men The Last Stand, which was the third X-Men film, did not do as well critically and was not as well received by fans, certainly, but did very well at the box office, made a lot of money. So it was natural that there would be more X-Men films made. So, naturally, the most popular X-Men character is Wolverine. So it makes sense that, at least on some level, that Wolverine would get the first X-Men spinoff movie. I mean, that, you know, that seems like the thing to do, and they did it. Well, for me, even though X-Men 3 was a huge disappointment, I was extremely excited for this movie because, as you guys all know, it is Logan Month. Wolverine is my favorite character in Marvel Comics. So I was pumped. Hugh Jackman's awesome. I was really excited. I wasn't sure about the casting of Liev Schreiber as Sabretooth. We'll get to that in a minute. But I was pumped about seeing Gambit in the movie. We had never seen Gambit on the big screen before. I was pumped about seeing the potential of Deadpool in the movie. I was really excited about just seeing Wolverine unleashed for the course of a full-length movie, as opposed to the focus on some of the other characters. So I was pretty pumped heading into this. Nick, I know we were all disappointed by X-Men The Last Stand, but what were your thoughts as this movie was in production?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the one thing you could say about the X-Men franchise to that point, and I would argue you could probably still say to this day, is that for all its you know, false steps along the way and mistakes that were made on the road to this movie, the one thing that the franchise had always gotten right was the handling of Wolverine. So it seemed like a natural fit to take Wolverine, spin him off into his own movie, which some would argue the X-Men franchise at that point had essentially been Wolverine movies anyway, but, you know, shed the trappings of having to give screen time to the other X-Men and set him up, you know, front and center as the focus. Then throw in, you know, fan favorites like a early version of Deadpool, which I'm sure we will discuss later on in the show, Gambit, as you mentioned, and various other characters, including a recast Sabretooth in the role of Liev Schreiber. And so it certainly made for a very intriguing, you know, project, especially when it was taken in, you know, the light of, or in the vein of, it seemed like this was Fox's attempt at retooling the franchise a little bit, because if you remember, this was the first of three rumored X-Men Origins movies. Yes, there was a reason for the clunky title X-Men Origins Wolverine, and the reason for that was that after this, originally they were intended to follow X-Men Origins Wolverine with X-Men Origins Magneto, and, if the character proved popular enough in Wolverine, X-Men Origins Gambit. That Gambit film, by the way, is still in development hell to this day, and the Magneto project, from what everything I've read and from what I, you know, saw on the screen, seemed to have been retooled into the first act of X-Men First Class. But
right,
that's neither here nor there. So yes, there is a reason for the clunky title, even if it was a bit off-putting at the time.
Yes, and actually, I would love to see a feature-length movie of Magneto just hunting Nazis.
Yes, I am not as high on First Class as a lot of people are. I have come to realize that, and to me, the most interesting part of First Class has always been, like, that bar scene with Magneto and the two Nazis. I could just watch a 90-minute version of that, I'm pretty sure, and
yep,
be very, very satisfied.
Well, while we've been talking about the backstory of the movie, we've been watching the opening scene here of this movie, which is it kicks off in 1845 in Canada's Northwest Territory with sickly James Howlett, who we later learn becomes Wolverine, and his friend, and we later learn half-brother Sabretooth, or Victor Creed. Mm-hmm. We've just seen Logan murder his what he thinks is his father's killer, but is actually his father, with a pretty clunky looking scene mm-hmm. with the bone claws.
Yeah,
where he first unveils the bone claws and lunges towards his father.
Yeah, he's meant to lunge, but it really just looks like he's gliding across the floor for some reason. It is one of a couple moments in this movie where it's very clear that the actor in question was on wires, and I don't really know why they needed a shot of Hong Kong style wire work in this film.
We're going to touch on that a little bit, but right now I got to interrupt because this is one of the best parts of this movie, and this is actually a part of the movie that I will say is pretty brilliant. Actually, the director of this film is Gavin Hood. We haven't mentioned that yet. This is the opening credit sequence, and I gotta say, this might be the best opening credit sequence of any of the X-Men movies. And all the X-Men movies have really good credit sequences. This is phenomenal, because what it does is, if you haven't seen the film, you're watching right now, we're following Logan and Sabretooth from that point in 1845 through pretty much every war that America is involved in. They fight in the Civil War. They fight in World War I. Now we're seeing them in World War II as Victor becomes increasingly more violent and Logan becomes increasingly more put off by that bloodthirstiness of Victor. We're going to see them in Korea. We're going to see them in Vietnam. Basically, they're going through every major American conflict. And I don't know about you, Nick. I thought this was a pretty impressive credit scene.
Yeah, I mean, the film along the way makes a lot of mistakes and seems very cliche at a lot of points. But this is one area where they actually, you know, bring a pretty innovative approach. It would be very easy, very easy to make an entire film about, you know, the years of Wolverine and Sabretooth, you know, going off doing things together and how that relationship evolved. But instead, what they give you is kind of a neat little way to bring you from the 1840s up into, what is it, Greg, the 1970s? Is that what it's implied to be?
Yeah, I believe it's in the late 60s, early 70s, yeah.
So just a cool way to jump forward 120 years and get you ready to be in the time frame that it needs to be if it's going to line up continuity-wise with the first X-Men movie.
Yeah, and the closest comparison I can make to it is the opening credits in the Watchmen movie. That's kind of what this reminds me of, the way that they portray the passage of time and give you really a lot of story just through facial expressions and subtlety to get to this point, to establish what the characters are like, you know, that clearly Victor has a bloodlust that exceeds what Logan or James has. We see, and now we're being introduced to this version of Colonel William Stryker, a character we first encounter in the tremendous X2, X-Men United. He was played by Brian Cox. Here, I'm not sure this actor's name. Nick, do you have this actor's name?
I do not. I can look that up, though.
Yeah, well, this is a recast, and it's a bit of a different version of William Stryker than we're used to. A little bit more of a sniveling, conniving William Stryker, as opposed to the more forceful, aggressive William Stryker that we met in some of the other films, including Days of Future Past and especially X2. But that being said, I think it works really well. He's a very, very compelling figure in the movie in terms of, yes, this is a different take on Stryker a little bit, but he's got just enough of that Brian Cox element in there and also just enough smarminess that you really want to see him get his by the end of the movie.
Yeah, the actor in question is Danny Houston, by the way, but I agree. When he's giving his performance, his cadence and his mannerisms kind of evoke a little bit of what you would think a young Brian Cox from X2 would sound like. So, not quite an impression, but something that's at least close enough to Brian Cox that you can see the link between the two. Something that I would argue you can't really see with the guy who played the young Striker in Days of Future Past and Apocalypse in recent years.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this, Greg, not to backtrack too much, but the opening from the 1840s, is that pulled straight from that Wolverine origin book?
Yep.
Okay.
I have a very complicated relationship with. That story, the story that is the basis of this movie, was actually done at the behest of Marvel president Bill Gemas, I believe. Or it might have been Joe Quesada. I can't remember which of them kind of came up with the idea to do that story. A lot of people like that story. A lot of people consider it a well-written story. My issue is not as much with the book itself. My issue is with the concept of it. I thought that Wolverine's origin never needed to be explained, much like the Joker's origin. I think Wolverine, a big part of his appeal was the fact that you didn't know his origin. When I was a kid, we had all kinds of theories about what his origin was. We would have arguments, again, on the playground about what Wolverine's real origin was based on the hints we had been given. And that was fun, and that was fine. And I feel like Marvel overthought it. And the reasoning that they did the book was, whoever it was, Quesada or Gemas or whoever came up with it, they thought that they needed to tell the story of Wolverine's origin before Hollywood could. And that's a direct quote from, I believe, the foreword of the book, is that they wanted to do the origin story before Fox had a chance to do it in the movies. I don't get that. I don't agree with that. I think that was a weak reason to do it. But it happened, and the movie is faithful to it. Whatever. So they go with that. That opening is pretty much completely out of the book. But yeah, what are your thoughts, Nick? Do you think Wolverine needed to have an origin spelled out?
I don't think so. Like you, I think if you're going to give the character an origin, it shouldn't be the definitive origin. It should be, you know, obviously you can't go with the multiple personalities angle that you go with the Joker so that he has different memories, but it's very easy to imagine doing a Wolverine origin story that's almost done like an anthology book or something, where you have these different people who claim to have interacted with somebody who looks like Wolverine at various points in history, and you can kind of do it that way, these
yes.
secondhand tales of the Wolverine, and you're not really sure if they were ever true or not true, but the idea of doing a definitive origin story I've never liked either. I like the mystery of the character, and I would argue that we've got too many characters in comics whose origins have been done to death, and it's kind of cool to have one of those who, you know, is able to maintain popularity despite not really having a widely accepted origin story.
Yeah, and I hate to keep going back to what I'm seeing on screen, but there's actually a lot going on already at this point in the movie. This opening probably 20 to 25 minutes of the movie is actually, for the most part, really good. Like, it's entertaining, it's crisp, it keeps going at a crisp pace. Right now we're meeting Deadpool for the first time, pretty much. He had an exchange on the airplane with Victor, but now we're seeing the personality of Ryan Reynolds, by the way, who's playing Deadpool in this movie. Wade Wilson, actually he's just known as Wade Wilson at this point, doesn't have a mask, but he does have the swords. And he's just been making smart-ass comments in the elevator, pissing everyone around him off. Perfect. From the first moment he inhabited this character, Ryan Reynolds was Deadpool.
Indeed. And you get a nice little over-the-top action scene with him as he's about to bust out of the elevator.
Bust through the elevator right now. And one of the best action scenes in the movie. This is awesome. He's swinging his swords around, deflecting bullets with his sword. If the movie would have been more of this, it would have been a better movie, because this is a great scene. Here he slices the bullet and deflects it into two different people, which is incredibly unrealistic and over the top, but hell, this is a badass scene.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a cool little, this whole little opening sequence, not just Deadpool scene, but it's kind of, the idea is to give you an introduction to what the role that each of these little characters fulfills on this team that Logan and Sabretooth have joined up with. And
Strikers, Strike Force, if you will.
Yeah, the old Strike Force, Team X, I think it's called, or something like that. Including the first appearance of what Greg and I will hereto refer to as Buffalo Blob in this film.
Yes, Fred Dukes, the character known as the Blob in the X-Men comics, one of the oldest X-Men villains, in this movie sounds like Buffalo Bill.
From Silence of the Lambs. And it also has another example of some really shoddy and terrible-looking wire work with Agent Zero doing a very clear wire-assisted jump over this fence, and it looks awful, and I still don't know why they did it.
Yes, Agent Zero, a.k.a. Phantom X from the comics, I believe. He does some bad wire work. Sabretooth, which is a recurring issue in the movie. First of all, we're going to talk about it in more depth as the movie goes on, but Sabretooth is one of the best parts of this movie, except literally every time he has an action scene, they do this weird effect where he gets on all fours and runs like a dog or a wild animal, and it's horrifically CGI'd. It looks so bad, and then he gets on a wire, and it's just bad. It's not good. Now, who is this other character supposed to be? I don't know that I picked that up. The telepath or telekinetic, I'm sorry.
Who?
The guy that can turn on light bulbs.
I have no idea, Greg. I was hoping you could tell me that.
You know, I don't know that I ever really picked up on that during the movie. I'm sure I should know, being an X-Men fan and all that, but he's such an unimportant character, ultimately, that it doesn't truly matter. So we meet them, and of course we meet Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas, who plays John Wraith, a teleporting mutant. They do a really good job with his he's a longtime X-Men character, by the way. They do a really good job with his ability, the teleportation. I really enjoyed how they illustrated that. However, Will.i.am's performance left quite a bit to be desired.
It was one of the areas of the film that, upon the recent rewatch, was actually worse than I remembered it being.
Yes, absolutely. By the way, the character that is the telepath, played by Dominic Monaghan, mm-hmm. is Chris Bradley, a.k.a. Known as Bolt and also known as Maverick.
Yes, I do remember around the time this movie was in production that the original rumor when Monaghan was cast was that he was going to play a version of Beak, and that clearly did not wind up happening.
And that's probably for the best. He's actually not bad in this movie. He just doesn't get a lot to do.
He's in like what, two scenes, three scenes?
Yeah, two or three scenes. One of which is probably my favorite scene in the movie, but we'll get to that, or at least one of my two or three favorite scenes in the movie. We'll get to that in a minute. Like you said, we're meeting this task force, and overall, we've bitched a lot about the CGI and the wire work, which is a recurring problem throughout this movie. The CGI is really bad, and the wire work is obvious and noticeable and unnecessary. But all in all, it's a very effective set of scenes here. We immediately establish here Logan's walking away from the Strike Force team. But we immediately establish that William Stryker is a bad dude. Victor Creed's a bad dude with a bloodlust. And that most of these other guys are just along for the ride. And that none of them like Wade Wilson. Now we're flashing forward several years, presumably, to the Canadian wilderness as Wolverine, a shirtless Hugh Jackman, walks out of his cabin and his heretofore unmentioned girlfriend.
Not to interrupt you or get you off kilter a little bit, but one thing I found a little weird about the scene that we just saw, or that you just saw, I should say. With Logan quitting the team, was the implication that you got from the film not the same as mine, in that it seems like Logan and Sabretooth agreed to join the team, they go on their first mission, Logan decides to quit the team after one mission, and everybody acts like it's some huge betrayal, and they're all deeply offended by it? Like, it seems like a very rushed sequence of events.
I didn't get the impression that was their first mission, personally. Okay. I got the impression that they had been on a few missions before the one that we see. Okay. But maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't know. His girlfriend, by the way, is Silver Fox, who's a long time, again, a long time X-Men character. She first appeared in the Wolverine solo book created by Chris Claremont.
But are we supposed to know that she's Silver Fox at this point?
No, she's just known as Kayla to this point. I'm assuming that Wolverine knows what her last name is, that her last name is Silver Fox. Literally, her name is Kayla Silver Fox. So, you know, which I believe is
Clark Superman.
Clark Superman. John Hawkman. Yes. So, she's his girlfriend and seems like they have an ideal relationship. Wolverine is working appropriately enough as a lumberjack. So, you know, I guess that's a natural job for Logan to go into after he's done superheroing or supervillaining or whatever they were doing.
Super soldiering, I guess, would be the...
Super soldiering. Ah, here is the scene I was talking about where we meet Maverick, Dominic Monaghan's character, as he is working at a carnival as a Connie. Small hands.
Smell like cabbage.
Smell like cabbage. And this douche boyfriend comes up and doesn't understand how he's doing his trick to keep the light bulb on. And it's pretty cool scene, showing off a little bit of the freak factor of mutants, which I think is cool. And he pisses off this young couple. But we're about to be reintroduced.
Yeah, but I noticed the young girl throws him a little look as she walks away. She's very clearly intrigued by what's going on there.
Oh, absolutely. She wanted her a little bit of that Hutt Maverick action.
Hobbit style.
That's right. And now we're seeing he's in his trailer, and we're about to be reintroduced to Sabretooth in an awesome way. There's a knock at the door, and this is the moment in the movie, because he had already been good to this point. I mentioned early in the film that I was not 100% sold on Liev Schreiber when he was announced as Sabretooth. Completely throw that out the window, because he is amazing in this movie, and I really appreciated him in this rewatch. He shows up at the door, and it was downright scary to watch this scene. Like, I felt bad for Monahan's character here, because as soon as Sabretooth walks in the room, you know that he's going to murder this guy. And this guy knows that he's going to murder him, and there's nothing he can do about it. And it's terrifying, and it's chilling, and Liev Schreiber just has this menace in his eyes in this scene that, you know, I've heard he's really good in this show, Ray Donovan, that I haven't watched, but you can see a little bit of that grittiness in his eyes here that I don't know that I had seen before in any of his performances. So this is an awesome scene where Sabretooth is just scaring the ever-loving shit out of this guy before killing him.
Yeah, it's a really great scene. You know, and that's the weird thing, is you would think that in a movie like this, you know, all the best parts would be action scenes, and they're really not. All the best parts of this movie have to do with Liev Schreiber being intimidating and actually acting, as opposed to,
yes,
you know, doing bad CGI'd fight scenes. And I would argue that
most of the worst parts of this movie are the action scenes.
That's the problem, and that's what makes it a little frustrating. Is, okay, there are a lot of bad things in this movie that aren't action related, and I'm sure we'll touch on many of them. But the thing is, there was enough here that they could have made at least a decent movie if they had just backed up the mostly good performances of the two co-leads with good action scenes.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a good – I maintain, I said this at the time, and I believe it even more after rewatching it. There is a good movie to be made from this. It's just not what they did, because Jackman and Schreiber give outstanding performances in this movie. I mean, Jackman had been playing the character now for 9 years, so he knew how to inhabit this role. He is Wolverine. We've talked about it on many podcasts. He is Wolverine at this point. But Liev Schreiber instantly stepped into the role of Sabretooth, made me forget Tyler Mayne ever existed. And
speaking of which, how are we supposed to reconcile that, by the way?
I have no idea. We'll touch on that when we get to that incredibly bad last two acts of the movie.
Oh, God, are we really going to get that far?
No, no. When I mean get to it in the discussion, not
I get you.
Watching the whole thing. But the no, you're right. They can't reconcile that. But yeah, he made me forget all about Tyler Mane. And the best scenes in this movie are when Jackman and Schreiber, the two best actors in the movie, are getting chances to act with each other and to show us what this relationship is, this really unique relationship between Logan and Victor. And by the way, Logan and Victor, that brings up an issue I wanted to bring up on this podcast, Nick, because I'm hoping you can give me some guidance on it, or maybe one of our listeners out there can give me some guidance. By the logic of this movie, we started the film with young James Howlett. To my knowledge, we're never actually shown the identity of the guy who kills old man Howlett, the previously thought to be the father of James Howlett, who we later learn was not really his father. We don't learn the name of the biological father in the movie, do we?
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay, so Victor is presumably this guy's son.
Yes.
Well, Victor's name in the movie is Victor Creed.
Yes.
You would assume that this other guy's name is Creed, right?
Yes.
Okay. Wolverine at this point still has his memories, as far as we know. He's James Howlett,
yes,
the half-brother of Victor Creed.
Yes.
Where in the hell does the name Logan come from?
It just sounded cool, Greg.
Because I swear to you, at a certain point, everybody in the movie just starts calling him Logan.
Well,
why don't they call him? But Sabretooth still calls him Jimmy and Jim, but everyone else calls him Logan.
I got nothing.
And I'll say one other thing. I looked at the end credits last night, and there is a character listed in the end credits named Thomas Logan. And if that's the name of the guy that kills the guy at the beginning of the movie, then why the hell is Victor Creed's name Victor Creed?
Well?
Ah! Power! Incredible power!
I got nothing for you.
If anybody out there in the Place to Be Nation can answer me as to why the hell, in this movie, not in the comics, in this movie, why Wolverine is called Logan instead of James Howlett, please send
us a message.
I
just read a theory online to answer your question.
Okay.
Some people are saying that he takes on the name Logan after leaving Stryker's team in an effort to conceal his whereabouts and true identity.
Okay, I guess. But what? But wait a minute. No, 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 no. Wait a minute. Why would Buffalo Blob and Will.i.am call him Logan later in the movie then? They don't know him as Logan.
I have no idea. I have not.
That's a big pile of shit is what that is.
No, wait. All right, so his dad that got killed, his fake dad, not his real dad. Wait,
yeah.
Okay. His dad that he thought he was his dad but is not his dad. What was his name again?
Something Howlett. I don't know.
Maybe it was Logan Howlett.
That's
a possibility.
I mean, you know what? I'm going to solve this right now. I'm going to go to IMDb. And I'm going to look up. That's right, folks. You're hearing how the sausage is made here. You talk, Nick. Talk a little bit about all of these scenes that I'm watching right now, off in the wilderness while Logan is lumberjacking. Ah, favorite scene. I've just gotten to your favorite scene, Nick.
That's what I was going to start on.
The story about Cuckoo Cachoo.
So as we're working our way through this part of the movie, which is oh so interesting and oh so believable with Logan's school teacher romance and whatnot, she imparts onto him this fable about this mythical being known as Kukuatsu or something like that.
Yeah, Kuakuatsu. Yeah.
And basically
Kuakuatsu.
The whole The whole thing is a big load of hippie bullshit that manages to set up the line. Cuckoo Kachu got screwed. What does Cuckoo Kawatsu mean? It means the Wolverine.
Did they not need Michael Caine for that scene?
They needed Michael Caine to play Kayla Silver Fox throughout the entire movie, I would argue.
Do you know what Kawekakwatsu means, sir? No idea. It means the Wolverine. To be more specific, sir, turns to the camera, it means the X-Men Origins Wolverine.
As he saunters over to Hugh Jackman and sits down in his lap.
Now come over here and give me a little bit of that Wolverine action.
Yeah, it's I hated that scene. I hated it. I remember hating it in 2009, and I remember hating it even more 2 days ago. So, good Lord, what a terrible, cheesy, forced scene.
Nick, the names of the characters in that opening scene: John Howlett, Thomas Logan, and Elizabeth Howlett.
Okay, wait a minute. So Sabretooth's dad is named Logan.
Yes.
Wait a minute. Okay, I got it. Here we go. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
No, that doesn't make any sense either. Never mind. I was going to say perhaps this Thomas Logan in question was just something of a man about town and was, you know, sowing his royal oats, so to speak, around this little Canadian village and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And you wound up with James Howlett, who took on the name Logan in honor of his true father. But perhaps Victor Creed also grew up in a household where he didn't know that this Logan character was his dad until later on in life, and had already grown up as Victor Creed, which with Creed being his mother's last name.
That still wouldn't make any sense, because why would Sabretooth refer to him and Wolverine as brothers at the beginning of the movie?
Because they'd be half-brothers under that scenario.
I suppose.
Well, I mean, they would be. I mean,
yeah, there's
no other scenario where they wouldn't. I mean, they're going to be half-brothers no matter what scenario you look at it under.
Yes, but that's a bit of an outlandish scenario, even by X-Men Origins Wolverine standards.
Listen, you just got to explain it away, Greg, somehow.
This is the scene where, by the way, where Kayla Silver Fox is seemingly murdered by Sabretooth, who is...
Oh, man, we get one of many close-up shots of Sabretooth extending his claws and the wonderful CGI that's on that.
Yes.
Including the claw marks across the dash of the car that seem to be appearing on the car before his claws are actually have made it to the area where the scratch is appearing.
And here's Jackman doing a great job of acting here. He's showing a lot of emotion. He finds his girlfriend's body. She's clearly been murdered. And keep in mind, I'm going to save this for later in the film. Wolverine has super senses. We are told that he has an ability to sense things that is beyond that of a normal human.
Now, to be fair, they attempt to explain that later in the movie.
They attempt to, yes. And he somehow is not aware, and this is a spoiler alert, folks. He somehow
is
not aware.
Seven-year-old movie. Eight-year-old movie.
He is not aware that instead of his girlfriend's actual blood, that his girlfriend has been doused with ketchup to fake her death.
Now, they never said it was ketchup.
I can only assume it's ketchup. I was told enough by people when I was a kid.
You're under the assumption that in that long trench coat that really Victor Creed is carrying around bottles of Heinz, huh?
Heinz or Hunt's, one or the other. I mean, take your choice. Catsup or ketchup. It's all going to the same place.
No sane, rational person would ever choose Hunt's over Heinz, for the record.
So Kayla's sitting there covered in this fake blood, and they gave her something to fake her death. But Logan thinks she's dead, and we get a cool scene, actually, where he shows up at the bar and he calls Sabretooth's ass out for a fight.
So are you saying that reports of her death could be indeed known as fake news?
I thought we were done with the topical humor.
Ha ha.
So
jokes on you.
We see a cool scene here. The bar clears out. Victor, in a rare moment of concern, actually asks the bartender if he has insurance on the place. The bartender says no. Sabretooth says, well, too bad for you. And now Sabretooth's about to whoop Wolverine's ass, quite frankly.
in terrible, blurry CGI fashion.
Yep. With bone claws. With stupid bone claws.
You don't like the bone claws, huh?
Never liked the bone claws.
So wait a minute. Okay, no, now hold on a second. We've always been told that his skeleton was, the adamantium was bonded to him at some point in his life.
Yes.
That's a thing even from the comics. So what is your issue with the bone claws?
Well, there's twofold issues to that. The bone claws actually were not canonical until the early 90s. Okay. Fatal Attractions. That is when that became a thing. But second of all, it's not, I don't necessarily have a problem with him having bone claws. My problem is always that I think the bone claws just don't look good. Usually in the comics, I don't think they look good, and they definitely don't look good in this movie. In my opinion. Maybe you disagree.
No, I would mostly agree. I'm just saying it seems like you have an issue with the concept of the bone claws in general.
No, I don't have an issue. I mean, it's another one of those things where I'm kind of 50-50 on it because I don't know that I like it or not. I think I would be fine if the claws were just add-ons to his skeleton that they did at Weapon X. But I have no problem with the bone claws. The existence of the bone claws makes sense to me. But I just wish that they looked cooler than they did. I don't know how I would change the look of them. They look like they should look. They look like long fingernails, basically. But God, this is a terrible scene.
The whole action sequence.
He threw Logan up on this log truck as it was going by, and it was some of the worst CGI you'll ever see.
Yeah, I remember specifically the spider web effect on the windshield just kind of appearing out of nowhere.
Yep. But Creed has whooped Logan's arse thoroughly right now. But no, the bone claws, you know, I can take or leave them. I just never like the way they look. I don't like the way they look in the comics, for the record. And I always think that it takes a little bit away from, you know, Wolverine's badassness. And you even see how, because Victor Creed literally just stepped on Logan's claws and broke them. So you'd assume that they'll heal back, which they do. But still. So let's talk about the cast of this movie. We always like to talk about the cast. It's a big thing.
Jackman and Schreiber pretty heavily already.
Yeah, we've mentioned them already. The other players, we mentioned William Stryker. He's fine.
He does
a solid job. Kayla Silver Fox, extremely bland and wooden, in my opinion.
Yep.
This actress...
Carol Ferris-esque.
Yes, Lynn Collins is her name, and you can make the argument early in the film that she's supposed to be kind of cold and distant because she's playing a character, essentially, and that her character is playing a character. I don't buy that because even later in the film, when she when her plan is revealed and we find out that she's a mole of sorts, it's still not convincing. She just doesn't have – she has about as much emotional range as – and here's a tie-in for you. Her sister in this movie is Emma Frost, who would later be played in X-Men First Class by the historically wooden and uninteresting January Jones. So
Greg has long had a major bone to pick with
Absolutely.
January Jones, if only she would give him the opportunity.
Whatever. I've never liked January Jones in First Class. I think that might be my pick, actually, for the worst comic book film performance. I'd have to really think about it. But it's awful.
No.
It is – she brings absolutely nothing to that character. Somebody out there has to back me up with that. But regardless, my point being, Kayla Silver Fox is a non-factor here. Very, very weak performance, in my opinion. Will.i.am, not strong. Thankfully, doesn't get a lot to do. Kevin Durand is who we need.
Yes.
Not Durand.
Woo!
Kevin Durand, who plays Fred Dukes, a.k.a. The Blob.
Buffalo
we got to give
Blob.
Him some credit. I don't know why he decided to channel Buffalo Bill's voice for this character who is a large fat man.
But it's awesome.
But it's awesome.
Yes, it is.
And he should have gotten his own X-Men Origins spinoff where he just eats ice cream the entire time and Logan follows him around making fat jokes.
And he mishears everything, and so he starts everything with, "Oh wait,
oh wait, hey Logan, are you here to find Victor? You didn't know that they're on the island." Yeah.
Did you just call me Blob? No,
no, I didn't. Oh,
my mistake.
Logan, did you just say you had a pie for me?
No, I said I said I'm here for you.
Oh, wait. Hey, Logan, remember when you were in the Beatles?
What?
It was awesome.
Why are you making Buffalo Blob Chris Farley?
I don't know. It just seems, it just felt right.
Oh, are we going back to referencing weird things from the WWE Women's Division?
I'm running down the list of cast here. Daniel Henney as Agent Zero. He's pretty good. He's fine.
I was severely underwhelmed by the inclusion of this character. Everything he did came off as really cheesy to me in this movie. Because all his action scenes were involved the terrible wire work.
That's
and, like,
true.
That was his entire, like, point of being, is that he didn't really have dialogue in the movie. His only point of you know, reason for existing in the movie was to be Stryker's badass, you know, henchman or whatever. And so every time you turn around, he's doing something really cheesy with bad CGI, including the, when they CGI the end of the cigar off when he shoots it off earlier in the film.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Like, it's just... So, yeah, Zero did nothing for me in this movie whatsoever.
And, of course, who could forget Tom O'Sullivan as logging supervisor?
Ah, yes, logging supervisor.
One of the stronger performances. But, no, we get...
But I think you're holding back on one that we have to get to, Greg.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well, first, before we get there, we do see a young Scott Summers, played by Tim Pocock here.
For no reason.
For no reason.
No
There's
reason.
Absolutely no reason to include Scott Summers in this movie, except... to set up a really creepily CGI'd cameo by what is supposed to be a young Charles Xavier.
Yes, and to set up the god-awfully atrocious climactic action scene of the film.
Yes, not good. Not good. But I know who you're referring to, Nick, but before we get there, I want to mention right now we are seeing this movie's take on Wolverine getting the adamantium put into him, and this is the dividing line of this film.
Yes.
From up to this point, for as much shit as we've talked about some of the aspects of it, it's actually been pretty good.
It's been solid. Pretty good. Not great.
Yeah,
but
not
it's
great,
been,
no.
It's
but
been pretty
solid.
It's been solid, yep.
Yep. After this is where everything goes to hell.
Shit.
And I'm going to go ahead and say one thing right off the bat that bugs me about this scene on the rewatch. It didn't bother me the first time. When you compare it to X2 did such a better job of just flashing back to this adamantium procedure. It looked grimy. It looked dirty. It looked creepy. And if you ever have read the character of Dr. Cornelius in the comics, he's a creepy, like, almost disturbing character to look at, to listen to experience. Here, he's just an old scientist guy. And he's honestly, I don't even know if he's named during the movie, but he's there. He's Dr. Cornelius. And... he's working with this other lady, and he's working with Stryker. The whole thing is too clean. It's too
it's just,
too pretty. It's too slick. It looks like they're in a normal, like, military facility, and they've got generals there watching the procedure and all that. I don't know how to explain it, but it just doesn't feel like I've always imagined Wolverine's adamantium scene looking. I always imagined it being clandestine. And, you know, packed with anonymous goons and just slimy, if that makes sense.
It's one of several scenes in the movie that make you stop and kind of go, how exactly is this supposed to line up with what we've already seen in the X-Men franchise? I mean, you know, the X-Men movie continuity would soon become as convoluted as its comic book counterpart in its own way. But at this point, we had only really seen three films that followed each other chronologically, and so the idea of tying this one in and making it seem like it fit in terms of continuity really shouldn't have been that hard. And yet there are numerous moments in this movie where you go, how does this jive whatsoever with what we saw in X2? It doesn't even look like the same procedure that's being carried out.
Here is the one part of the scene that I do like. Well, we're not there yet, but there's the non-creepy Dr. Cornelius. But we're about to see when he pops out, when he hears them talking about erasing his mind, he pops out of the chamber and lets out this, like, feral roar. And they shoot him in the head, and he just shrugs it off and almost has this demonic look on his face. To me, that was a good shot. That was a good scene. Or not the scene, but the shot was excellent. And the way that they played that off was good.
I just thought about this, but they've done that scene in what, 4 X-Men movies now?
Yeah, the scene of the bullet going into the head and then bouncing out. Yep.
No, I mean the popping out of the tank scene.
Yeah.
Because they did it in
Days of
X2.
Future Past. Yep.
They did it in X-Men. Or, excuse me, they did it in X2. They did it in Origins. They do it in Apocalypse. And they do it in... That may be it. But
yeah.
Maybe 3. It's just they've done that scene to death. 3 different versions of the same damn scene, for God's sake.
I mean, he's an animal in this scene. I like this. See, now there's random goons that pop out of nowhere that weren't there before. And I like that. He's running away. You know, this is horrible.
Not you, henchman, arbitrarily turning dials to make it look like you're doing
what about
doing
the terrible CGI, Nick, when he cuts the X in the door to pop out? Oh, my God.
And it makes no sense. He has, like, 3 claw marks, and somehow it enables him to kick out this massive section of, like, 6-inch steel that is just perfectly sized enough for him to fit through. It makes no sense whatsoever.
No, and just awful CGI that was corny. What a corny scene.
But we're talking about bad CGI, and we have not yet reached the pinnacle of
bad CGI
in this movie, which is coming up here pretty soon.
Yeah, but before we get there, I want to mention him because you brought him up. Taylor Kitsch plays... A version of Remy LeBeau, a.k.a. the Cajun X-Man thief, known as Gambit.
Oh.
And this was the first time
that
we have seen Gambit on the big screen, and to this point, the only time that we've seen Gambit on the big screen. Although, as a little Easter egg, the name Remy LeBeau actually appeared as early as X-Men 2.
Right.
On a mutant registry, which was a nod to what was potentially coming in the future. But all I can say is, as a Gambit fan, I'd rather have never seen him on the big screen than got what we got in this movie. An alternating accent that just seems to... Anybody that's ever watched the cartoon knows how Gambit is supposed to sound. At the very least, he's supposed to sound Doc Holliday-esque from Tombstone. At most, he's supposed to sound like a caricature of a Cajun person, as he was done on the X-Men cartoon show, which we all love. But here, he will occasionally have Cajunisms. He will occasionally have just generic Southern Alabama-style accent. And then at other times, he'll have no accent at all.
Or at one point... The scene with he and Logan in the plane, he slips almost into a little bit of a Canadian accent for some reason. And it's just...
It's all over the place. In one scene, you might see him, you know, he'll be talking to Logan and he'll be like, hey there, you want to play some cards? And then it'll be like, well, that's not, he'll be like, what kind of cards you play? Well, I've never heard of a card game like that. And it's a dumb thing.
It's a dumb thing to harp on.
Nick, the worst CGI scene.
Okay, let's pause the Gambit rant for this.
Oh my God! So Logan has been taken in by this kindly Jonathan and Martha Kent like farming couple, and he's in their bathroom and he's examining his new metal claws for the first time, and for no reason at all, after not doing it to this point in the movie, the claws are CGI'd.
Yes.
And they look awful.
They do not even look like they are attached to his hands.
No, it looks like somebody took a 1998 Apple computer and created computer graphics with it.
It's atrocious.
There are sparks flying off of his claws, and the sparks look like they were Photoshopped in.
And it looks even worse as he starts to inadvertently destroy the bathroom around him. By, like, slicing the sink in half and stuff. The sink, when it gets sliced, looks terrible. The radiator that gets sliced looks terrible. Just everything about it just looks
It looks
awful.
Really bad. And it's a shame because I think there was potential in this scene. The kindly couple, they're good.
Greg.
Logan is good. But
there's no excuse for it, though. This came out in 2009, same year that Avatar came out. Like
Abaddon.
The technology to create decent-looking CGI was there. I mean, And it's almost unfair to compare it to one of the best, you know, special effects of all time, but consider the fact that Terminator 2 came out in, what, 1991?
Yep.
18 years before this film, and its CGI is much more believable than what we see here. There's no excuse for it to be this bad.
You're right. There is absolutely no excuse for CGI that bad. That was the point when I was watching it in the theater when I was like, oh, no. I had no idea what was to come. But that was, you know, we mentioned the Adam, when he gets the adamantium in him, it turns into a totally different movie. And it's a shame because even with all this horrible CGI, there's still some good things that happen in this scene. You know, we get to see the classic Wolverine brooding, which is always, you know, you got to have that. But we get the unnecessary, the completely unnecessary flashback audio of Wolverine remembering the stupid Quetzalcoatl, whatever.
Cuckoo-ca-choo
rant. But we've already seen, by the way, not, what, 10 minutes ago. So, you know, it's just, you know, this is where the wheels are coming off. But back to Gambit. The accent is just all over the place. The characterization, I don't understand what his motivations are from minute to minute.
He has no motivations.
First he fights Wolverine because he thinks Wolverine's there to get him. Then he stops Wolverine from killing Sabretooth, even though Sabretooth was the guy who grabbed him, and he should know that Sabretooth is bad. Then he randomly changes his mind and decides to help Wolverine. Then he abandons ship and, you know, and leaves him to infiltrate the thing and doesn't really follow through on his plan to free everybody.
And if he knows Logan's entire backstory because he knew him before he lost his memories and then encountered him after he lost his memories, why doesn't Professor X years later just look up Gambit and be like, hey, tell him what happened?
Tell him what happened, Gambit. Well, maybe he too was tired of Gambit's stupid accent and mentally killed him.
It's a stupid thing to complain about. I'll grant you before I even complain about it, but when I think of Gambit, I do not think of shiny button-up purple shirt and a cheesy hot top hat or whatever he had.
No, like, I agree.
Where the hell is the Gambit costume? Like, the Gambit costume that we all know and love.
And the effect of his cards was so disappointing.
Oh, awful.
I mean, they don't even
explode. They didn't even try.
No, they don't even explode. They just make contact and force people back. Just not.
And instead of being, like, pulsing with energy, like glowing red like we saw in the cartoon, it's like they just have a faint hint of purple about them, and that's the best they can do in terms of CGIing these cards.
Then again, perhaps...
he only uses the cards once in the movie, by the way. Once.
Perhaps it's for the best that they didn't try with them, because if they try, we get a scene like we're about to see here, where Agent Zero and his helicopter...
This is the worst scene in the movie.
As Wolverine drives his motorcycle out of a cliche exploding barn...
Yes.
We think
looks like some of the worst green screen work, you know, this side of the Star Wars prequels.
We think that it can't get any worse, but it does, because later on in this scene, you're going to see Wolverine take down the helicopter of Agent Zero, which is fine. But when the helicopter crashes, Wolverine lights his cigar up and uses the cigar. Or no, I'm sorry, he doesn't use a cigar. He uses his claws to spark a gasoline trail back to the helicopter and blow it up and slowly walks away from the exploding helicopter like it's 1995 all over.
Doing
again.
A slow motion walk away as the wind blows through his hair, and then the green screen explosion takes place in the background, looking like something out of a mid-90s Michael Bay movie.
So cliche. Like, I almost expect the Beck song Novocaine to start playing. It was playing in all the late 90s trailers for action movies. There's just no excuse for it, to be honest with you. I don't understand. And that brings me to my next point. We've talked about the cast, and I think by and large, huge exceptions with Taylor Kitsch, Will.i.am. By and large, a service.
Glenn Collins.
A serviceable cast for the most part.
Yeah, decent enough.
But
really, the movie is carried
performances. But
yeah, it's carried by Jackman and Schreiber. I mean, that's the thing. Like, even if all the other performances were pretty bad, the movie is so focused on those two characters that you could ultimately say I think the acting in it would at least be decent. So,
but let's talk about the director. We mentioned his name, Gavin Hood. Heading in, this was a pretty weird hire from the get-go. Heading into this, his only prominent work was the movie Solixi, which won an Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. He had never done an action movie. He had never done a prominent film. He never did a big budget movie. You know, the budget for Satsi was $3 million. This was a huge risk, and as it turns out, a bad risk. He ended up after this movie doing Ender's Game, which I actually liked. I thought it was a good movie, but a lot of people didn't like it. But I enjoyed it. But before this, I mean, he just didn't have any kind of experience to do this kind of a movie. And I think it shows. I mean, it shows from his decisions with how to approach the action. It shows from his pacing, which is all over the place. The decision we talked about at the beginning of the movie, Nick, to use wire work in this movie, like Hong Kong style wire work, was absolutely unnecessary, out of place. It just sticks out like a sore thumb with what the movie is. Because the movie, on one hand, seems to be trying to be this emotional, introspective movie about Logan's personal turmoil. But it also wants to be an over-the-top action movie. But it also wants to show off its special effects budget. But it also wants to be gritty. But it's rated PG-13. So it's like, it's got all these different things it's trying to be, and it feels like Gavin Hood never really picks a direction and goes with it the way that James Mangold did in later Wolverine films.
Yeah, definitely trying to serve too many masters. I think that's clear from what you just said. I mean, it winds up being something of a jumbled mess of a movie.
Yeah, and the writers of this one, David Benioff and Skip Wood, certainly don't do Gavin Hood any favors. But listen, you can't the script is one thing, and the script has its issues for sure. But you know, not the least of which we're going to talk about in just a second before we finish off. But for all the script issues, there's just no excuse for how bad the action is in this movie and how badly paced it is, and just the uncreative, uninteresting cliches that are littered throughout it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. There are parts of this movie that are defensible, but so much of
certainly,
it is,
yeah.
But so much of it is indefensible, just because, like you said, there was no reason in 2009 with the budget available to have action scenes as cliche and quite frankly boring as the action scenes they produced, nor to have CGI that was as embarrassing as the CGI they put on the screen.
And what an elaborate plan that William Stryker had, by the way. Convince your agent, Silver Fox, to go undercover for what appears to have been quite some time. Would you agree?
Yes.
To play Kayla, Wolverine's lover, fake her death. Assuming all this was to set up a faking of her death with the sole purpose of convincing Logan to volunteer to get adamantium put in him. Just a very elaborate plan from Stryker.
Yeah, and it's especially weird from a screenwriting standpoint in that you have Kayla, you know, playing a role, fake her death, reveal herself to be alive, and be on the side of the bad guys, turn babyface by joining back with Logan and hint that they still have a romantic future, and then ultimately actually be killed off.
Yep.
It's just a lot of twists and turns for that character.
Logan is so okay with her having tricked him for years, you know? Like, he gets over that literally in 10 seconds. He walks out the door and he hears her scream and he realizes, you know what, I do love her. Even though she literally has been lying to me for years, pretending to be someone she wasn't.
Oh
God. Anyway, because that sounds a lot like Wolverine, by the way. Someone that just forgives and forgets really easily, right?
Just going to let bygones be bygones. We're just, you know, water under the bridge.
That's always been his character. No, well, now we're reaching your favorite part of the movie, the boxing scene.
Yes. Woo!
Here we go. Tell the folks about it. Tell the folks about what makes this scene stand out so much.
So basically, what we have here is Wolverine just showing up at John Wraith's boxing ring for no adequately explained reason, because we're led to believe that he hasn't kept in touch with any of these guys in the years since, and he's just showing up here. In another example of the film having something of what Greg calls Green Lantern Syndrome, where things just happen for no adequately explained reason. But anyway, here it is hinted that the Wraith pretty much says that Fred Dukes, a.k.a. Buffalo Blob, has had closer contact with Stryker and Sabretooth in the years since Logan left the team, and he suggests that he try to get the information out of Fred. And here we are introduced to... That's one thing we didn't mention earlier in the film, Greg. At our initial look at Fred Dukes, we are told, or we see that he's a relatively normal-looking guy, despite the fact that in the comics, wasn't part of the Blob's mutation his overwhelming fatness?
Yes, that was actually kind of the whole point of the Blob.
But here, he simply develops an eating disorder after after leaving the team and gains approximately 700 to 800 pounds. And I'm assuming a large portion of it was gained through drinking what appears to be gallon-sized Slurpees at all times.
Here's my favorite part. Wolverine walks up to him and goes, "Hey, fat Fred."
And then at one point he goes, oh, that's funny. That's real funny, Logan.
That's real funny. Wolverine calls him Slim. Wolverine. See, this is cool because this is exactly in character with Wolverine to make these little pot shots.
But yeah, and then you get all the lines that Greg and I repeated earlier in the podcast. Yeah. So it's just a cool...
Did you just call me Blob?
No.
No, I didn't. Oh, God.
And then he belly bumps him like 30 feet across the room.
Yes.
Oh, God. Ridiculous.
Ridiculous. No, but... we've talked so much about the bad stuff. Let's go ahead and get to this whole, like... last 45 minutes of the movie, when you see Logan's going to eventually find out that Stryker and Sabretooth are in cahoots with one another,
right.
And he goes to hunt them down and put an end to it with the help of, for some reason, Gambit
flying an airplane. Yes,
right. So noted pilot Gambit,
and that's when he dips into his redneck accent. Oh, this is my baby. I won her in a card game.
Yeah. Taylor Kitsch's understanding of Southern dialects reminds me somewhat of Nicolas Cage's understanding of Southern dialects, which is to say that, well, if my character's from Mobile, Alabama, that's kind of close to New Orleans, Louisiana. So naturally, he should have a Cajun accent. Put the bunny in the box. We've harped a lot on Taylor Kitsch, but deservedly so, I would argue.
Awful.
Now it's time to harp on the other elephant in the room that we haven't talked about. So earlier in the movie, I mentioned the excellent appearance by Ryan Reynolds as Wade Wilson, later to be known as Deadpool. Well, in this movie, we find out that William Stryker. Has been working on a Weapon 11 that he calls the Deadpool.
No.
Presumably named after the Clint Eastwood movie of the same name. And...
It's a pool of mutant powers. He's been collecting mutant powers and putting them in this pool that is... he has created with the help of a dead body. So it's the Deadpool, you see.
The Deadpool.
Batman.
Yeah. Sabretooth chasing Cyclops in the school with horrendous, again, just abysmally bad CGI. Like, I mean, I'm trying to think of an example here, Lord. Sub that Dire Straits video in the mid-80s. CGI. But anyway, back to the point. So, we find out that Weapon 11 is the carcass of Wade Wilson with his mouth sewn shut.
Literally sewn shut.
with all of these other mutant powers that we've seen in the movie. Well, to be specific, let's be honest, he really only uses the mutant powers of a few. He uses John Wraith's teleportation that he took. He uses Scott Summers' optic blasts.
Right.
Because that's what Deadpool does.
He uses Sabretooth and or Logan's healing factor.
Healing factor, and he has katanas that come out of his forearms the way that Wolverine's claws do.
Right.
And he appears to have some sort of generic strength and speed. But they have a facility with, what would you say, Nick, probably 25 to 30 mutants in it?
Yes.
And he doesn't use any other power. He doesn't use telepathy, telekinesis, anything like that. But regardless, it's stupid enough as it is. So I don't want to have retroactively given them any ideas. It's dumb enough to have Deadpool be a character with his mouth sewn shut. The merc with the mouth has his mouth sewn shut and shooting Cyclops blasts out of his eyes.
Yes, and they actually at one point in the creation of the Deadpool, Greg, didn't they carve out the skin around his eyes to like replicate
yep.
the black circles on Deadpool's mask or whatever? It just
yep.
it comes across as one of those classic examples of, you know, this was only a year removed from Iron Man, and before Iron Man came out, we lived in a world where a lot of people thought that you couldn't just take the comics and throw them on the screen because people would think it was dumb and hokey. And this just smacks of that. Like, it seems like the last real vestige of Hollywood people going, well, you know, we can't just, you know, do the comics because people will think it looks dumb.
Hollywood in its typical 12-year-old mentality. What would look awesome? What if, like, Deadpool had, like, swords coming out of his hands? And what if he, like, could shoot blasts out of his eyes? And what if he could, like, teleport? Oh, dude, that's awesome.
Well, now, to be fair, in the comics, Deadpool can teleport, right?
Can he? I don't know.
I remember that being a power in Marvel Ultimate Alliance.
It was in Ultimate Alliance, yeah. Maybe he can teleport. I don't know. I apologize to any Deadpool fans if I'm wrong that he can't teleport. He can't shoot optic blasts.
That's true.
He doesn't have swords that retract from his arms.
No, he does not.
He doesn't have his mouth sewn shut.
No, he does not.
He doesn't look like Baraka from Mortal Kombat.
Baraka Pool, yes. Although it did give us the little bit in Deadpool with the action figure, so maybe it was all worth it after all. Greg.
Just to get the actual Deadpool movie, but yeah. I mean, and it sets up a really bad, one of the worst climactic action scenes in a superhero movie.
Yes,
Wolverine,
where Sabretooth yep. turns face again literally no reason other than nobody kills you but me.
Nobody kills you but me, and we're brothers, we gotta watch each other's backs. Even though Sabretooth was literally ready to let William Stryker murder his brother earlier.
Now I want to see a version of this movie that has Chris Farley and David Spade in the roles of Logan and Sabretooth. We're brothers. Brothers gotta hug.
Hug. Oh, Richard.
Oh, Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy, that's Silver Fox. She's a pretty girl. Wouldn't know.
I wonder if her boyfriend plays for the Yankees.
Jimmy, who's your favorite little rascal? Is it Alfalfa? Or is it Spanky? Center. Oh, that's the movie we should have gotten. But
yes.
No. So,
Jimmy boy.
in any event. It's a terrible ending to this movie.
It really is.
You see that? Oh, and we didn't even mention the magic adamantium bullet that actually isn't magic after all. You see, William Stryker's big plan to take down Wolverine is he's got 6 adamantium bullets that he's going to shoot Wolverine in the brain with.
Yes.
Well, for the duration of the second half of the movie, we're convinced that that's the MacGuffin or whatever. I don't know if that's the right term, but that's what we assume is going to come back later in the movie. And it does, except right before the climactic action scene, there's a seemingly throwaway bit between Dr. Cornelius and Stryker, William, where...
What the hell was that?
That was my attempt at Brian Cox's voice from X-Men 2 when Mystique is impersonating him. It's a deep cut, admittedly. But he... Cornelius tells Stryker, and I'm not making this up, I'm not exaggerating, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick. He tells Stryker something to the effect of, you realize that won't kill him. Not even that bullet can stop him now. To which Stryker replies, that's okay, I don't need to kill him, but his brain might recover, but his memory won't. What an oddly specific bullet that must be, Nick.
And one that, if you're taking the entire franchise as one long string of continuity, we were shown in Logan later that the adamantium bullet, you know, just blows your skull apart. How come that didn't happen here?
As it should, you would think. But
yes.
No, here, it apparently is like Superman's kiss from Superman 2, in that it has the ability to knock out the specific portion of your brain that controls your memory.
Yes. So, and not all of your memory, just like certain aspects of your
parts
memory.
Of it, yes. And Stryker was certain he knew which parts.
Yes. He had expert aim. That was his mutant power. He could aim for certain brain cells.
He was like long shot.
Yes.
He could what is the classic X-Men Marvel explanation for it? He can affect probability fields.
Yes, probability fields, my favorite.
But yes, so in any event, mercifully, I'm going to end this here, and we're gonna cut this movie off. There's much more to talk about. If you're watching with us, feel free to continue watching, or don't.
Yeah, you go right ahead.
I'm going to also mention, I didn't know this until last night, Nick, when I noticed on my DVD there was not a scene included that was in the theatrical cut of this movie. And I was positive that it was. I was like, I know I saw this scene. And so I looked it up online to prove me right. And here's what the situation was. The scene in question involved, it's a post-credit scene.
Yes.
And it involves Wolverine sitting at a bar in Japan, which seemed to set up the sequel, where he's drinking. And the bartender asks him, are you drinking to forget? And he said, no, I'm drinking to remember. And it seems to set up that the next part of Logan's journey will be in Japan. Well, that's not on this DVD anywhere. Can't find it. It's not there. Instead, on this DVD is a post-credit scene that is that picks up after the climactic battle with the rubble that is left behind from the big Wolverine and Sabretooth versus Deadpool fight. And the rubble begins to move, and you see a hand pop out of the rubble, and it's Deadpool's body, and it grabs the disembodied head of Deadpool and puts a finger up to the head and goes, shh.
I think I can explain.
And I know why. I looked it up, Nick. They filmed multiple post-credit scenes and only showed one of them per showing.
Yes.
And so some DVDs...
Everybody got the mid-credit scene, the useless mid-credit scene of Stryker being arrested, but only certain productions got, you know, each respective post-credit scene.
Yep. And the fact that they didn't include both of them on the DVD is just mind-numbingly stupid.
But it wouldn't matter, because none of the setup that this movie did in its post-credit scenes came to fruition.
We got a much
there
better
was a Jap- there was a Japan-set Wolverine movie, but it had nothing to do with X-Men Origins Wolverine.
No.
And there was a Deadpool movie, but it had nothing to do with X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Thankfully.
So,
but you know, we've railed on this movie a lot. What did you think, Nick, were the good things in this movie that maybe you realized on this rewatch that you didn't remember?
Well, I don't think that I didn't remember. I would say that pretty much all the dramatic scenes with Jackman and or Schreiber were just better than I remembered them being. I remembered them being pretty good, but there is some really menacing stuff from Schreiber, and Jackman, as always, is consistent throughout. So I think the performances were better than I had remembered, honestly. And again, the first like 25 minutes of the movie is fine. It's pretty well paced. You know, there's some shaky CGI, some shaky action, but there's enough moments in there that kind of keep you engaged. And so it's like, it has the first, I don't know if it's the first act, maybe like the first half of the first act of a good movie.
Yeah, I think the main thing that struck me on the rewatch was Schreiber, who I liked in the theater, but I was mainly focused on the Wolverine stuff. I think he was the biggest surprise. I think some of the stuff like Logan sitting at the table with the family and the death of the old couple was better than I remembered it being. I think there were aspects of the script that were a little bit better, but there were also aspects of it that were worse than I remembered. The CGI was much worse than I remembered it being, and I remembered it being really bad. And Stryker's nonsensically complicated plot was not there. Obviously, this is not a very good movie. Would you say that this has earned its reputation for being as bad as it is? Or would you say that that maybe it's not as bad as people think? Or is it even worse than people think?
I will say that it is not quite as bad as the reputation it's earned, but it's only slightly better than that reputation. I think what this really comes down to is a discussion about what is the worst movie in the franchise, and I think we all would agree that it's either got to be X-Men 3 The Last Stand or this. And having not seen X3 in a while, and just going off the top of my head of what my memory of it is, I would say this. The Last Stand, to me, has more wasted potential and is more consistently bad throughout. Whereas this, at moments, is much better than X3, but I would say at other moments, it is much worse than anything in X3.
Yeah.
When this movie is bad, it is the worst. Its bad moments are the worst moments in franchise history.
Yes, I would agree with
you. I guess if I'm having to pick one over the other and say which one is the worst in the franchise, I'm going to go with this one just because the highs here aren't really nearly enough to balance out the tremendous, tremendous lows.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. You said it perfect, Bubba. X-Men 3, I think, is a case of just wasted opportunity, wasted potential for what could and should have been the best of the X-Men movies. Like you said, kind of a consistent dullness about it. Missed opportunities, missed marks. But I'd have to say this is worse. Even though I agree with you, the highs here are higher than any of the highs in X-Men 3, but the lows here are so much lower. I don't think there's anything in X-Men 3 that approaches...
There's nothing in the franchise as bad as that bathroom scene.
No, the bathroom scene, the Deadpool scene...
The
helicopter scene. Nothing in X3 is that... X3 doesn't have anything that's that bad. It just has scenes that should have been much better. But, yeah, so this has got to be the worst in franchise history. Obviously, that includes the other Wolverine movies, both of which we like a lot. Yeah. We had talked potentially about reviewing the Wolverine for this month, but we wanted to revisit this one. Nick wanted to revisit this one. I'm actually glad that you did, because it was worth revisiting and talking about.
Well, I think you and I both have seen the Wolverine several times since it was released, because we enjoy it so much, whereas this is probably the first time I've seen this one since the theater.
Yeah. I think I watched it a couple times maybe on HBO.
I mean, I've caught bits and pieces on like FX or whatever, but I have never sat down and watched from beginning to end since 2009. So
right, yeah, I agree. And now the question becomes, this is the worst, we've decided this is the worst of the X-Men movies. Where does this rank in terms of modern era, let's say post-X-Men superhero movies that you've seen?
Because
I've never seen Catwoman the whole way through. I've only seen
parts. It's not as bad as Catwoman. It's certainly not as bad as Elektra, which I maintain is worse than Catwoman. This honestly, and I think you're gonna laugh at this one, I think, it's not as bad as the first Fantastic Four movie, but I would put it in terms of the ones I've seen, I think it's Ghost Rider / Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer on that level, probably, for me.
Mm. I can't knock that.
Not quite the bottom of the barrel, but the next rung up. How about that?
Right, that's fair. I think that's probably fair. I think it's a little bit, maybe a little bit better than Ghost Rider. I think it's maybe on
there
par.
There is no Sam Elliott mustache in X-Men Origins Wolverine, I will remind you.
That's true. I think there's enough here to keep it above that level. I would probably, I definitely don't think it's the worst that I've seen. I don't think that it's in the very bottom tier. I would say that it's probably, I would put this on a par with Suicide Squad, probably, for me.
So that's a really good comparison that I hadn't even thought of, Suicide Squad. Yeah, I would, yeah, why not? Yeah, that sounds about right. I think maybe, honestly, I probably like Suicide Squad a little bit better than this, but.
Yeah.
You know.
Probably so, yeah. It's pretty close between them, the two of them. I mean, this one had a lot of, again, I would also say that Suicide Squad probably didn't have highs as high as the good stuff in this, but Lord Agreed. Almighty. Again, folks, you just haven't seen anything like that bathroom scene. But in any event, folks, mercifully, we're going to bring an end to this one. Let us know your thoughts on X-Men Origins Wolverine. This movie does have some defenders out there. I've read about it online. I don't understand it, but it's out there.
Yeah, you were among them at one time.
No. This is an inaccuracy, like you claim the inaccuracy of you being an anti-Archite, which you've been proven to be. I defended the first half of this movie, and in hindsight, I was a little generous on half. But I maintained that the beginning of the movie was what I was looking for from the Wolverine movie. But I can't defend the entirety of the movie because there's just no defending the back half of it. The first half is a solid movie. The second half is just atrocious. But if you guys – maybe you guys disagree with us and would like to change our minds or let us know your thoughts on – this movie, or maybe you want to pile on and think we weren't harsh enough. Let us know. Contact us on Twitter at gphillips8652 at nickduke87. Shoot us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com, or join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and let's have at it. Let's have a discussion, folks, and chat it up about this unique situation, quite frankly, and see what the nation thinks about it. But with that being said, folks, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we've got reading, watching, we've got the rundown. Stay with us. You don't want to miss it, brother.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, geek, and sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's conversation, and imaginary stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Story was teased, then Hulk 180, then 181, your tale had begun, those big hairy arms, you can't be harmed, smoke cigars, short arm charm, adamantium claws, and skeleton, named Logan, Canadian, your secret past, you had no clue. Best that there is what you do. Don't let your rage grow high, Wolverine. Wolverine.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, after that rousing discussion of everything that was X-Men Origins Wolverine. We're here with a great segment, the longest running segment in hard traveling fanboy history. It's time for
reading and watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Oh yes. Oh yes, that's what everybody wants to hear, that right there. And with all that being said, we are ready for reading and watching. Nick, how should we kick things off this week? Should we kick things off with reading, with watching? How should we do it?
Let's go reading, since you've actually read comics this week.
I've read a lot of comics this week, some of which I can't locate at the moment, but I've read them. I've read a lot, and I'm gonna kick us off here at with my number three comic book of the week. Number three. And that is going to be none other than Green Lanterns number 12 by Sam Humphries and an artist whose name is Pansica. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But, nevertheless, this is part of the Phantom Lantern storyline that has been very entertaining from the get-go. The artist is Eduardo Pansica, by the way. This is an issue that focuses a lot on the Phantom Lantern himself, showing a little bit more of his backstory and his time with his girlfriend. We also see some really cool conversations between Volthoom, the First Lantern, and Rami, the rather unique hippie-looking guardian. The really good exchanges there, really good focus on Simon Baz here a little bit more than we've seen in the book. Really good issue, top to bottom. I'm very much enjoying the Phantom Lantern. I think he's a great addition to the Green Lantern mythos, and very excited to see where this is all going from there.
Awesome. Good to hear that you're enjoying that. For my number three book of the week, I'm going to keep it in the Green Lantern line. I'm going to go with Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 16. This is a book that is almost entirely a ring-free fight between Arkillo and Guy Gardner. And throughout the fight, you get Guy Gardner having some flashbacks to his childhood and kind of some of the events that shaped him into the man he is now. And this issue is just a great reminder of why everyone should love Guy Gardner and why he's among the best characters in all the Green Lantern mythos, which says a lot. So loved the hell out of this one, and love the continued focus on Guy as a major part of the core, which some writers have tended not to to give him that respect since Geoff Johns left. But glad to see Venditti is focusing on Guy in a big way once again.
Better respect his ass is what you better do.
Absolutely.
Very good. Very looking forward to that one for sure. Number two for me is Wonder Woman number 14 by Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott. This is the finale of year one, and it's been a long time coming since the beginning of Rebirth. This story's been building and building and building. Here you get the confrontation between Diana and Ares, who's kind of her big bad in this new continuity, and many other continuities as well. Really enjoyed the confrontation between Diana and Ares, and particularly the fact that Diana cannot defeat Ares in hand-to-hand combat. It's not possible. It's made clear that she knows that, he knows that, and she doesn't even try. She tries to talk him down. She tries to use peace to defeat him, and it works. She ends up defeating Ares with her lasso of truth and with the help of her patron gods. And we also see her bond with Steve Trevor with some wonderful art from Nicola Scott. Some of her best work, I feel, on this series. Just a great issue. A great issue that sets up why she's called Wonder Woman. It sets up more about the dynamics. The rather interesting flirtation between Etta Candy and Barbara Ann Minerva. And yeah, just a great issue. I've just continued to love this Greg Rucka Wonder Woman run. I think it's one of the best things going right now in comics.
Absolutely. And I might have more to say in just a few minutes. But anyway, Moving on to my number two book of the week, I've got Detective Comics number 952. This is the second part of the League of Shadows storyline. And I loved pretty much everything about this one, especially from a writing standpoint. You know, James Tynion just the fourth just continues to show a mastery of each of these characters, whether it be Clayface or Batwoman or Cassandra Cain, who gets a couple of great emotional moments in this book, or Batman himself. I mean, just great moment after great moment for each of these characters. This is just kind of the prototype for what a team book should be, in that, you know, clearly each issue focuses on one character over the others, but it makes sure that each character gets a moment to shine, which is something that DC, as I'll discuss here in a little bit, is struggling with in some of its other team books. So, loved Detective Comics 952. It and All-Star Batman, you know, are both great Batman books. When you throw in a pretty good Batman book in Batman, this is, you know, one of the best bat lines we've had in some time, and I'm loving the hell out of it. So, Detective Comics 952.
Excellent. Well, that sets me up for, why not stick with the Batman line? My number one book that I read this past week, Batman number 15 by Tom King and Mitch Gerads. This is part two of the brief Rooftops interlude about Batman and Catwoman and their relationship. This is one of the best comics I've read all year to this point. This, to me, is probably my favorite Tom King Batman issue now. I think it's almost – it's virtually perfect. The artwork is exceptional and patient. And the way that these love scenes play out and the way that the artist here, Gerads, draws the pain in their faces but also the love in their faces is – tremendous. The brief scene with Jim Gordon in his bathroom trying to tell himself that he's going to die of smoking is hilarious and wonderful. The Dave Gibbons-esque 9-panel layout, exceptional. This is just a great issue. Loved how they brought Holly Robinson back into continuity a little bit of a different way. I absolutely adored this issue. I will say if there was one thing that kept it from being one of the best Batman issues of all time for me, it's that I didn't quite love that last line that you loved, the one about the night.
Oh, I loved it.
I thought it was, you know, it was okay. But that being said, great issue of Batman.
And so you bought the explanation of the murders then?
Yes, I did. Yep.
Okay. And see, Greg, just let it all play out. For God's sake, just lighten up, Francis, and enjoy the product from time to time. And you'll be much better off instead of bitching about it on Twitter for 6 months.
I'd suggest that either your only options are either to enjoy the entertainment that you are viewing or reading, or simply stop viewing or reading it. Quite frankly. That's it.
Quite frankly. In any event, my number one book of the week is Wonder Woman number 18. This is the second part of the God Watch storyline. And this is kind of something like a Wonder Woman year two type story they're doing after the events of year one. It's picking up, I think it said something like 20 months after Wonder Woman left Themyscira. And this book has so many great moments, but what I really love it for is it's making it clear to me now that it seems as if Greg Rucka's entire rebirth run to this point really is the story of Barbara Ann Minerva and her relationship with Wonder Woman. This is continuing to be one of the greatest character reclamation projects since Geoff Johns and Thal Sinestro all those years ago. I am loving this. It has instantly vaulted the Cheetah into among my favorite DC villains going right now, and just so much emotion, so much pathos, and you get the full backstory of the events that led her to become the Cheetah, and what exactly happened, and why exactly she has such a beef with Wonder Woman, and it's just heartbreaking stuff for both characters involved, and I absolutely love it. Greg Rucka is killing it on this book right now.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And I think for both of us, we've never really been Wonder Woman readers up to this point. And it's been a run that's been so good that it's turned us into Wonder Woman addicts of sorts for this series. So very, absolutely. Very impressive. And also impressive, no magic memory erasing bullets. Thus
no.
far.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Well, let's not rule it out.
We don't want to say it's impossible. Well, let me get to my bottom book of the week, and this was an easy choice for me. Unfortunately, I can't find the issue. I think I might have left it back on my trip to my parents' house over the weekend. But this – so I can't tell you who the artist is. I know Tim Seeley's the writer, but it's Nightwing number 10. And this was the first part of the Bloodhaven story arc where he – relocates. He's trying to find himself a little bit after his mishaps with Raptor, which I enjoyed towards the end. So he's relocated to Bloodhaven and is trying to kind of get back in touch with who Dick Grayson is. He's been Nightwing for so long. He went undercover twice in a row in these deep, dark organizations. And he wants to just find out what hobbies he has left besides just being Nightwing. Doesn't go very well. And honestly, it's blown through and blown off really quickly in the issue, in a manner that I wasn't very satisfied with. I think you could have gotten an entire issue just out of that. There are parts of this that I liked. I still continue to like the way that Tim Seeley writes Dick's dialogue for the most part. There are a couple lines here and there that are a little, I think, were probably more clever in Tim's mind than they are on the page, but overall, I really enjoy the way he writes Nightwing. However, I am just not invested in any of these other people that he's meeting in Bloodhaven so far. That's an issue in this one. But the big reason why this made my bottom list is at the very end, it does a pet peeve of mine in a comic book in the last page. There's a character that Dick meets early in the issue named Shawn Sang. She is a... somebody that works at a clinic to help the poor. He's trying to volunteer there. He's got kind of a crush on her. Turns out She's a former supervillain that is kind of reformed or whatever. We don't find that out till the very end of the issue. There's a last page reveal where Dick walks into a room expecting to see Sean. And when he walks into the room, she's in costume. And he looks at her and he says, "Defacer." And it's done in a way that seems to imply you're supposed to know who in the hell Defacer is. I have no idea who the Defacer is. To my knowledge, there has never been a character called Defacer before. This is an original character. To the best of my knowledge, I could be wrong, and I'm sure I'll be corrected if I am. But it's a huge pet peeve because it's not an effective cliffhanger at all. Like, the effective cliffhanger is if the character walks in and sees a previously established character and says, "The Riddler," or "Magneto," or, I don't know, even if it's a small, like, the Cavalier, for God's sake, not a character that has never existed before. Because, yes, they explain in the next issue that Dick knows who she is, clearly, but they don't explain that to the reader, and it's important that the reader knows who she is and knows why Dick recognizes her. That's not established till the next issue. I thought it was a mistake. I thought it was a bad way to end the comic. And kind of, to paraphrase our good friend Andrew, left bad taste in mouth.
Indeed. I know that's disappointing for you, given that you're such a big Nightwing fan. I know you've wanted a little bit more from his book than you've probably gotten to this point.
Yeah.
Moving on to my bottom book of the week, I'm going with Justice League of America number 2. The first two issues of this have honestly been very disappointing, given how good all the Rebirth specials that led up to it were. But it's just, it seems when it comes time to put all the characters together, Steve Orlando just isn't doing a very good job of juggling them. And listen, I love the character of Batman. Batman's my favorite character in comics. But I don't need another book on the stands that focuses on Batman at the expense of all the other characters. Detective Comics is doing it right now. Batman plays a major role, for sure, but every character gets a moment to shine. Here, it's just Batman, and the other characters are just kind of there, with the exception of Lobo, who gets to make funny jokes every now and then. But that and the villains of Lord Havoc and his, whatever his group is called, just kind of boring. And it's
the Knights of Wondergore?
No, unfortunately. But it's just kind of boring, and it's another example of a substandard DC team book right now. And unfortunately, as much as I wanted a good Justice League book on my pull list, I think I'm done with this one going forward.
Wow. Hold the plug.
It's okay. And like we've said before, in this era, in the Rebirth era, okay is not good enough to justify $6 a month.
That's fair enough, my friend. I can't blame you for that. It is an expensive hobby that we have. No question about that. But let's move on to quick hits. And do you want to just alternate or do them all one at
a
time?
Yeah, we'll alternate. Go ahead.
I'm going to get us started with Nightwing number 11 by Tim Seeley and Marcus Toe on art. This is a good issue. This is a nice rebound from number 10. This did address the problem that I had with 10. But again, I can't give 10 credit for what 11 does. So solid issue. Not great, but solid.
Awesome. I've got Jessica Jones number 6, wraps up the initial story arc in very satisfactory fashion, and seems to be moving the focus on to the marital status of Luke and Jessica, which is a story I'm very interested to see how they pay off.
Green Lanterns number 13, and I'll go ahead and include 14 in that as well. 13 and 14, this wraps up the Phantom Lantern arc, and very enjoyable. I really enjoyed this story. Val Thum is an incredible villain. Like you said, Nick, I now kind of want to go back and reread Wrath of the First Lantern. Very effective. Enjoying this book by Sam Humphries.
Dr. Aphra, number 5, continues to be a very entertaining Star Wars comic. Triple Zero and BT continue to steal the show. But here, even the Black Chrysanthemum gets in on the action. I'm kind of loving the father-daughter dynamic they've got going on in this book with Aphra and her dad, so enjoying this Star Wars title right now.
All right, very good. Action Comics 972. This is wrapping up Men of Steel. I would classify this as a a solid effort. Nothing special. Just a decent comic. Well drawn by Steven Segovia. Did enjoy the Clark Kent and Lois interactions a lot more than I enjoyed the Lex and Superman stuff.
Absolutely. Batgirl and the Birds of Prey 8 continues to be a pretty good little Batgirl and the Birds of Prey comic here. I'm enjoying this one so far. And as a shout out to you, Greg, I actually got a couple of lines about the Defacer in here, and I also had no clue who she was, other than apparently she and Dick are romantically entangled somehow.
Oh, boy.
But a solid comic nonetheless.
Looking forward to that. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
Nightwing pages. Moving on to Action Comics 973. This is an issue that really that has Lois at the forefront as she is attempting to go on a date with this Clark Kent to find out information about him. It doesn't go well at all. It all falls apart. I thought this was an awesome issue. This was one of my favorite Action Comics in a while. Really has me interested in the Clark Kent situation heading forward. And I know that is a big reveal this past week. I haven't gotten there quite yet, but I'm pretty close. And I'm really interested to know why he is so emotionally immature, I guess you would say.
Indeed. And speaking of that, Action Comics 975. This is a well-written issue. It's well-drawn. I personally found the reveal to be very underwhelming. But that comes from me as someone who is not a longtime Superman fan. So others will disagree and clearly have. I know a lot of people who love the reveal. It didn't do much for me personally. It kind of left me with just a feeling of, that's all. After all this build. But I will say the backup story by Paul Dini is excellent. Much better than the main story, and actually made the reveal not as bad for me in hindsight. So, interesting read nonetheless here in Action Comics 975.
Interesting. Superman number 15. This is part 2 of Multiplicity, which is, of course, a story involving Superman from different Earths going to battle against someone who's trying to steal all of their powers. I thought this was a good action-packed issue. Not great. Little silver agey for my tastes, but still good overall, entertaining, and kind of feels like a good Grant Morrison comic, if that makes sense.
It does. That was the compare. I think I thought that when I was reading it myself. Old Man Logan 19. Sadly, no Andrea Sorrentino art on the interiors, which makes me worry that I think Sorrentino may be done with interiors in this comic. I'm not positive about that, but it's still well written. I didn't love the art at all, honestly. The plot focuses on Logan going to the various magic and science based heroes of the Marvel Universe, seeking for a way to return to the wastelands, and them all rejecting him and turning him down. So it's cool to see him interact with a wide swath of the Marvel Universe, but mostly, I would say, an ultimately forgettable issue of a series that's been largely outstanding to this point.
And finally, for me on my quick hit, Superman 16, the conclusion of Multiplicity. Liked this one, didn't love it, but thought it was a good way to wrap this story arc up and tease things to come, potentially in the future with Dr. Manhattan. So, interesting comic.
And finally, on my quick hits, Titans number 9. I like this book for the most part, but I continue to find the characters of Bumblebee and Rocket just thoroughly uninteresting in every way. So that's kind of frustrating.
And that brings an end to our reading, which means it's time to get on to watching. And last week we had all new episodes of the CW shows except for Arrow, which was taking yet another unnecessary and nonsensical break. But let's start it off on Monday night. And Nick, what was going on Monday night on Supergirl?
Yes, Monday night on Supergirl was kind of the second part of a two-part arc that focused heavily on the character of Jeremiah Danvers and played by Dean Cain. After we saw in the previous week's episode, you know, he was back with Cadmus, and they had kind of got this plan to target all the different aliens of the world using this alien registry that the DEO had that Jeremiah had stolen. And so you kind of get, you know, a story that largely deals with Alex in for the most part, having to come to terms with the fact that her dad, you know, clearly isn't who he said he was, and that he is, you know, still withholding a lot of things from them, and that she finds herself on an opposite side from him, and she's trying to balance her sense of responsibility to her family with her sense of responsibility to the DEO, and it leads to a very good episode of Supergirl overall.
Yeah.
Probably the strongest Alex-based episode since the big coming-out episode of a few months back.
Yeah, I agree. I thought this was an excellent episode. Everything worked for me in this. Mon-El continues to work for me. Just his relationship with Kara is special. They have great chemistry. Wynn's subplot, I think, is actually going a little under the radar right now. I don't see a lot of people talking about it. I'm really enjoying the story of Wynn's romance with this alien woman. It's adding a dynamic to his character that honestly needed to be added after he really hasn't gotten much attention this season. Not much at all of James, which always is a good thing for me. Dean Cain, to me, is delivering big time as Jeremiah. I'm a huge fan of his anyway, but I think he's doing a really good job as Jeremiah. And Alex and Kara continue to be believable as daughters that don't want to think the worst of their dad. And, I thought the action here was great. I thought the stakes were high and believable. Like, I actually thought there was a chance that Alex might be sent away in that ship. There was a moment when I was thinking, oh, wow, they're actually going to send Alex away and have to go get her or something, you know? It was really well put together, well paced, well directed. I very much enjoyed it. The only thing that I would say about it that I didn't love is, even though I appreciated the sentiment and I agreed with the sentiment, the snapper car scene at the end was heavy-handed, as are a lot of snapper car scenes, to be honest.
All of snapper car scenes.
Yeah, really, really on the nose. Really, almost a caricature at this point of an old-timey news editor, in the way that Perry White always was, too, in the comics and the cartoons and the movies, but in a less obvious way, a less obtuse way, I suppose. Just a little, just heavy-handed and you know, they could dial down his characterization just a little bit and make him a little bit more of a realistic, believable character.
Yeah, sadly, it doesn't seem like they have any intention of doing so.
Yes. Tuesday night, of course, brought us a brand new episode of The Flash, which is really ramping it up. This was a Savitar-based episode where Wally West, well, let's be completely frank, Wally West screws up everything. Is that fair of me, Nick? Is that too harsh?
It's mostly fair, yeah.
Savitar is in Wally's head, still trying to escape from the Speed Force. He needs the fragments, as we learn in this episode, of this Philosopher's Stone in order to escape from his prison in the Speed Force that future Wally, we believe that future Barry has put him in. So Savitar goes about the process of tricking Wally into throwing that Philosopher's Stone into the Speed Force where Savitar is waiting for it and wants it. Now, we also see in this episode Barry is really on edge. He's been on edge all season long. He snaps at Wally and probably begins the ball rolling on this whole sequence of events. So he shares some blame too, certainly. But, I mean, Wally's just so impetuous. And understandably, he's young, but good Lord, what a mistake he makes. And allows Savitar to escape the Speed Force and then subsequently trap Wally inside the Speed Force. So, a lot happened in this episode. Very eventful, and I thought it was a very good episode.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. Even Iris got a cool little moment to shine with, you know, their emotional fallout of the revelation of Barry's true reason for wanting to get engaged to Iris and kind of the way she deals with it, I thought was emotional and logical from her standpoint. Mm-hmm. I'd be pissed if I were her as well. So, yeah, pretty much the whole episode works, and HR continues to to kill it pretty much every week.
Yep.
Joe continues to be great, and the Flash has just kind of hit its stride finally after kind of, you know, some ups and downs over the first half of the season.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. And Grant Gustin put in another just stellar performance. So really looking forward to how this all comes to be. And I don't know if we should discuss our Savitar theories yet or if we should hold off on that, Nick.
Let's hold off in the interest of time.
Yeah, I agree. We're running a little late right now, folks. But let's move on to Legends of Tomorrow. This is this show, I've made it clear, has been, I think, you know, arguably, along with Arrow, the best of the season thus far from CW. This episode was interesting.
Although Flash is finally starting to catch up. Yeah. I think really all the shows have seemed to have hit their stride lately.
Yep. And refresh me, Nick, because I've watched a subsequent episode. What was Legends about last week?
So Legends had two main plots, one of which involved Ray and Amaya and Nate being stranded back in the Cretaceous period that Ray was previously stranded in earlier in the season. And it also dealt with the team of Jefferson and Sarah attempting to make a trip into the mind of the evil Rip Hunter in an attempt to free his true self from the manipulation that the Legion of Doom had placed upon him. So you get kind of this weird mirror version of the Dark Mirror version of the Wave Rider and Dark Mirror versions of each of the characters who inhabit it. And in one of the episode's more bizarre aspects, a living human embodiment of Gideon who shares a couple of romantic moments with Rip Hunter.
Very strange. Yes, that was unusual. I thought it was, you know, I'll be honest with you. I thought that the scenes in Rip's mind were a little bizarre. They were hard to follow at times. Not bad. There was still some really good stuff in there. Sarah continues to be awesome every time she appears.
Yeah, Sarah versus Sarah was a pretty cool fight.
Yeah, that was cool. So. Yep. And the I am not really at all invested in Nate and Amaya, primarily because – I like Nate, but primarily because – I'll go ahead and say it. I like the character of Vixen. But they got to give her something to do, something more interesting to her personality, because she's just not that interesting to have monologues and everything. Like it's,
I'm actually more invested in their relationship after this episode, because Ray pretty much lays out like all the consequences this relationship is going to have.
And I was going to say,
so it actually makes it a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, and I was going to say Ray was great in this episode. Like Ray was hilarious. He's really
Ray's great most weeks. Most weeks, not every week. He has not reached a Mick Rory level of consistency quite yet, but he's getting there. He's getting there.
Yeah, and so I am interested to see where they go with that romance going forward. But no, a good episode of Legends, even if for me it felt like a little bit of a step back from recent weeks, which have been just on fire. And that's it. That's it for the CW shows. So let's rank them, Nick, for the week.
Oh, man. Let's go Flash. No. Let's go Supergirl, Flash, Legends.
Ditto. That was my ranking as well. I'm very surprised by that because I loved Flash. I thought nothing would be able to top Flash last week. I think Supergirl did it.
Admit it. It's the focus on Dean Cain. That's what's doing it for you.
Hey, and you know what? Terry Hatcher has just come on board.
And now comes the Terry Hatcher and the Kevin Sorbo.
Yep. I don't really care about Kevin Sorbo, but Terry Hatcher, yes.
You weren't an Adventures of Hercules fan, Greg?
No, I wasn't, actually. I watched Xena, but I didn't watch Hercules.
How dare you.
But let's move on to Sunday night and AMC's The Walking Dead coming off of just an abysmally boring episode in which nothing of note happened. We get an episode in which a lot of note happens, or at least a little of note happens.
I'd say a good bit of note, yes.
And a fair amount of note. And this focuses on the kingdom and the kind of rogue known as Richard and, of course, Morgan and Carol. Now, in the course of this episode, we learn a lot. We learn what the future is going to hold for the kingdom. Things get accelerated. And a character meets an end.
Yeah, we reach a point by episode's end that we all knew was coming. It was just a question of how long it would take them to get there.
Mm-hmm. And you know, overall, I thought it was a good episode. You know, I really did enjoy it. I don't think it was one of the best in the season, but I thought it was a good episode. I liked
the episode, and again,
I really liked the performance by Lenny James. I thought he was who plays Morgan. I thought he was outstanding, and particularly in a certain scene when he started thinking about his deceased son Dwayne. I thought he was really good.
I like the episode in terms of we all knew that the kingdom was eventually going to agree to join, you know, the force and fight against the saviors. Right.
Right.
I didn't foresee them taking the route that they took to get there in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my issue with the scene you just referenced, or some of the scenes involving Morgan, I should say. This episode portrays him as being on the brink of insanity, a la Morgan from a few seasons back, in a way that hasn't really been done on the show in quite some time, and it kind of feels convenient for the writers to just bring that back out of nowhere. I needed more foreshadowing of that. I needed more of Morgan dealing with his mental state and struggling with it, rather than him just all of a sudden reverting back to a previous characterization, something that I have made the argument that they've done with Carol to a large extent, where they took her and they made her, had her make her peace with the fact that violence was necessary, and then randomly moved her backwards. And I feel like they're doing a little bit of that with Morgan at this point.
I see where you're coming from. I think I can see him snapping in that situation, though. I can see, but here's the problem. But I agree with you to this degree. They did not spend enough time this season in all their slowdown episodes that they had. They should have been showing Morgan being a father figure to this guy more than they did.
Exactly. Yep. We have not been given a reason to believe that relationship was, I mean, what this episode does, it pretty much tells you this relationship is almost as important to Morgan as his relationship with his son was. And there has been nothing in this season to this point to make us actually see or believe.
Right. I agree with you on that. I think that's fair. I think what saved it for me was the acting from him.
Oh, the acting is great.
But,
My criticisms are almost entirely from a writing standpoint.
Yeah, I agree. And I get you where you're coming from on that. I certainly would agree with that. They needed to give us more of that relationship if they wanted to make that an earned. We talk a lot on this show about earned moments, and that was an unearned moment.
Agreed.
Well, anyhow, with all that being said, let's move on to our next segment. Unless you've watched anything else this past week, Nick, that was comic related that you want to talk about.
Not that I can recall.
Excellent. Well, let's move on to a little segment known as
Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
Oh, that's beautiful. It is, isn't it? It is beautiful. But we're not here to talk about that. We're not here to talk about our jingles. We're here to talk about exciting news and notes from the comic book world. And among those news and notes, FX's Legion has been renewed for a second season, although we're not going to get it for a while. The show, which has been running on FX for the last several weeks, certainly an interesting show. I'm still not sure if I like it or not, but I watch it, and it's entertaining. I'll give it that. It's going to be coming back. We're just not sure when. It looks like it's going to come back sometime next year. And then the other thing is, what else got renewed, Nick? Something else got renewed. Riverdale, a show loved by some, hated by some, and ignored by many. And this is a show about Archie and whatnot, and it's been renewed for a second season. Good for Riverdale, good for Archie.
Indeed.
All right, so from there, let's move on to again, a recurring segment of our show, the DCEU Corner.
Yes.
There's a lot.
Which one are we going to tackle first, Greg?
Well, I think the biggest news of the week, certainly, would be the release of the Wonder Woman trailer.
Yeah.
We got a brand new trailer for Wonder Woman that highlights some of her origins on Themyscira. Shows our first look at Connie Nielsen as Hippolyta. And is indicative of some of what we can expect to see going forward. So, Nick, what were your thoughts on this the trailer this week? I liked it. Don't think I loved it.
Yeah, my thoughts pretty much exactly. I thought it was cool to see more of the Amazons and more of Themyscira. I thought it was cool, especially to see how all of the Amazons are using this vaguely Mediterranean type accent.
Yep.
That kind of sounds more in line with what Gal Gadot's normal, speaking voice is, and what we heard from her in Batman v Superman. And it just makes logical sense that these group of women wouldn't speak, perfect Americanized English after spending millennia by themselves on an island. So, yeah, I liked the trailer. Didn't love it, but continue to look forward to this one.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I think that the trailer was a good one that got me excited for got me moderately excited for the movie. I'm still going into this one cautious, but like I've said from the get-go, this movie doesn't have to be great. It just needs to be like its trailer, good.
Good, exactly. I agree.
Well, while we're talking about the DC Extended Universe, where should we go next? Let's see. How about...
Let's go with what could be a bit of good news first, and let's move over to that directing rumor.
Ah, yes. That would be that a report came out. The always reliable sources have indicated that Matthew Vaughn, the director of X-Men First Class and Kingsman, the sequel... Man of Steel 2. Vaughn is currently directing... he's got a sequel to Kingsman coming out later this year. But he has been attached previously to Warner Brothers projects. It's been said that if he does not choose to do a Superman film, they still want him to do a movie in the DCEU. This seems like a great fit, Nick. I think this is a move in the right direction. If they can get him and let him make the movie that he wants to make, I think he'd be perfect for the DC universe. I don't know if he's necessarily the right guy for Superman, but he might be.
Yeah, I mean, I think he can definitely do Superman. I think, especially X-Men First Class, it kind of has a little bit of this bright, poppy kind of aesthetic to it that I think could fit well in a Superman movie if they're truly looking to move that franchise in a little bit of a different direction, which I think is needed at this point. My only request is that if he is going to do a Superman movie, no more Lex Luthor, please.
Yeah.
Or at least no more of this version of Lex Luthor, please.
Yeah, give us Clancy Brown. Don't give us Eisenluther.
Remember back during the build to Batman v Superman when the rumor for a long time was that Bryan Cranston was going to do it and it sounded awesome?
Yep.
Whatever happened to
remember
that?
Remember when we all had in our
what?
Minds...
Why didn't that happen?
Remember when we all had in our minds that Lex Luthor was going to be portrayed seriously for a change with a menacing...
At least he didn't have a wacky real estate plot.
That's
time.
True. That's true. He had a wacky pit the heroes against each other plot.
Yes. But no, on the topic of Matthew Vaughn, I think this would be a good choice for some kind of DCEU film. He's proven himself to be an accomplished visual stylist. And he almost always has a unique take on whatever his subject matter is. So I'm very hopeful they will be able to get him on board, although I don't know if it's going to wind up happening.
And please, no Lex, no Zod, no Kryptonian enemy. Brainiac or bust at this point for the enemy. Although...
No Maxima, huh?
Hey, I'd be fine with Maxima. Hell, I'd be fine with Mixie. I'd be fine with
Mixopetalik.
I'd be fine with any of the classic Superman villains, except Lex.
I admittedly do not want a Mixopetalik.
What if we got Gilbert Gottfried?
Now that's a different story.
Very good. But let's stay with Warner
Bros. Or, hey, on that Maxima topic, Greg, what if they got Maxima for the villain and applied the rumored approach we're going to talk about now?
This is a report via Newsarama that we just saw today. Actually, they're accrediting it to the Wrap, so of course take it with a grain of salt. But an unnamed DC Films employee. Now again, this is baseless speculation hour here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Says that the studio, Warner Brothers Studios, DC Films, are now completely open to doing an R-rated superhero film. According to a well-placed insider at Warner Brothers, DC Films, 100% yes, with the right characters, they would be willing to do an R-rated movie. This, of course, comes on the heels of Logan's overwhelming success, Deadpool's overwhelming success. I like the fact that the source says with the right characters. Again, we're talking about this as if it's true. It probably isn't. It may not be. I don't know. But it would stand to reason that now studios are not going to be as gun-shy to make these R-rated movies. However, Nick, am I alone in this, in worrying that Warner Brothers will take the wrong lessons from Logan's success?
No, you're not. They've taken the wrong lessons from so many things over the last 10 to 15 years that I'm like you, I'm worried. They will think that gratuitous, over-the-top violence is what made Logan successful and ignore its focused story and plot.
Yep.
They will think that, you know, and granted, gratuitous violence is part of the thing that made Deadpool successful.
Sure.
But Deadpool, it was because the gratuitous violence and over-the-top humor was pretty much just directly lifted from the
it served the
character. Makes that character who he is. And I am worried that we're going to wind up getting an R-rated superhero movie that doesn't need to be R-rated is my ultimate concern. However, that all being said, never going to happen in a million years. I would kill to see WB do an R-rated Question movie.
Ooh, I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah. Or R-rated Lobo.
R-rated Lobo would be pretty badass. But then I'd want The Rock to quit Black Adam and go play Lobo.
Deathstroke. Yeah, there's a couple of characters that it would work for. Suicide Squad. It would make perfect.
Suicide Squad sequel. Yeah, hopefully.
There are certain characters it works for. What I don't want to see is another R-rated Superman movie.
What about that Gotham City Sirens movie? You know,
Margot Robbie, you know, with certain provisions.
Wolf of Wall Streeting it up a little bit.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. But no, I mean,
Joe's doll will let go.
But yeah, the secret to Logan and Deadpool's success isn't they have violence and cursing in them. It's they are good movies.
They understand the character they are telling a story about.
There are reasons for the violence and reasons for the swearing. And that's the point is not the violence and the swearing. The point is the story. The point is the character. That's what has to be right. And I'm just worried they're going to take the wrong lessons. I hope I'm wrong. I hope we get some badass movies like the ones that we've mentioned in the future. All right. So that's the end of the DCEU corner. We've only got one more for you, I believe, and that is a big announcement from Marvel. They've released the full lineup and creative team for what we thought was going to be X-Force is actually going to be Astonishing X-Men, which was the title of the Joss Whedon and John Cassidy book in the mid-2000s that got rave reviews from pretty much everybody who read it. The lineup first of the team. This is going to be, let's see here. Old Man Logan, Archangel, Mystique, Rogue, Gambit, Bishop, Psylocke, and Phantom X. It is a who's who of popular 90s characters and Phantom X. And,
what the hell is a Phantom X?
Phantom X was a Grant Morrison creation from the new X-Men era. He's actually Agent Zero. Agent Zero that you see in the Origins
now,
of the Wolverine movie.
To be fair, I am right now looking at the Phantom X Wikipedia page, and it makes no reference to him being the same as Agent Zero.
Really? Well, I've always assumed that, but Weapon Zero, I think, might have been Weapon something. He was a part of the Weapon X program.
David North is a fictional mutant character, originally known as Maverick, and more recently as Agent Zero.
What? Yeah, Agent Zero. Okay.
But that's not Phantom X.
I am so terribly confused. Weapon 13, that's what I was trying to think of. Not Agent Zero, Weapon 13. But a reason I thought that Phantom X was Agent Zero is that his whole deal is guns.
Yes.
He was part of the Weapon X program. Or the Weapon Plus program, I should say, not Weapon X.
Weapon X, Weapon 11, Weapon 13, Weapon Plus. These weapons get a little confusing
after a while.
They do.
And anyway, so Phantom X, his whole deal is he shoots guns and he's accurate and he probably has a healing factor. I don't remember much about him except that he has kind of a Storm Shadowy look from G.I. Joe. So he's part of this team. Now, as for the creative team, Charles Soule is going to be writing this one. It feels like he writes everything, I know, but...
He writes 30 books a month.
And we love him for it. And the the artists have not been specified, although Jim Chung provides the teaser image. But we don't know the full-time, I don't think, illustrator. Maybe we do. I don't know. But what I do know is that Charles Soule's a great writer. He's very good, anyway. Maybe not great, but he's very good. And this looks to be a potentially compelling series. I really like this lineup a lot, although I do wish Bishop had the Jerry Curl.
Yeah, I wish Bishop had the Jerry Curl. You know, we had some reservations about Old Man Logan being included. And I kind of question, I mean, I understand that the X-Men franchise lends itself to multiple teams, but now you have three different teams calling themselves the X-Men running around at the same time. And that just seems a little bit like overkill. I think even if you just called it X-Force, I think, you know, some diversity among the team names could be used. But that's a minor nitpick, and this whole resurrection deal is really not aimed at me anyway. It's aimed at longtime X-Men fans, of which I am not one. Not saying I won't check some of these books out, you know, eventually anyway, but I am not the person whose approval they are seeking.
Beg the question, why is Wolverine on two different X-Men teams? But, you know, I'm sorry, Old Man Logan on two different X-Men.
I wonder if in the book they will actually call themselves, hey, we're X-Men Blue. And we're
well,
X-Men
no, what
Gold.
They did back in they will, but what they did back, at least if it's like back in the day, they actually explained it in story that basically they divided the teams up into a gold strike team, strike force team,
a strike team,
and a
okay.
blue strike team, and they did
that's going to make them feel really bad whenever the gold team and the blue team are like, yeah, we're strike team blue and we're strike team gold, and then like, yeah, we're strike
astonishing.
How did you guys get the cool name?
And also, how is Logan going to divide his team between the Astonishing and the whichever one he's on, blue or gold?
He's on gold.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. It also, as interesting as this looks, it also does look like, you know, again, one of those things where there's really no reason for these particular characters to be teamed up, but somebody was just like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if all of these badass characters were together? But...
Yeah, I'm not going to blame them too much, because I think when writers get to write the X-Men, I think part of the appeal of getting that assignment is getting to kind of fantasy draft your own team out of it, and that's pretty much what they
did. Yeah, and they did a good job. I like all these characters, you know, again, except for Phantom X, who I don't know much about, but the rest of these characters I like.
And what's remarkable is, you know, Soule was able to fantasy draft Old Man Logan, which I had been led to believe was not allowed, so that's interesting.
Well, certainly if he's, yeah. I would think it would be especially hard if he's already been drafted by another book, or seven other books, as it may be.
Clearly, there will have to be some sort of protest process that takes place now.
When are we going to do the next fantasy draft, by the way?
In 2018.
Oh, my.
Remember, it's the biannual Place to Be Nation Peter David Memorial Fantasy Comics Draft, presented by a hypothetical unnamed DC Comics Online
now,
Unlimited.
Now, what if by 2018 we have an actual DC Online subscription service?
Well, then we'll be brought to you by Armor Vienna Sausages.
Very good. I like that thought process there. Well, that being said, folks, we've gone long tonight, but we hope you enjoyed the show. Nick, tell the folks what they can expect in the coming weeks.
Absolutely. Next week, we're going to wrap up Wolverine Month with a very special edition of Countdown, in which Greg and I will count down our top five favorite X-Men The Animated Series episodes of all time. The following week, we will be bringing you a very special giant size edition as we take a look back at DC Rebirth almost 1 year in with something we're calling DC Rebirth 1 year later. That will also happen to be our landmark 50th episode of the podcast to date. And then in 2 weeks' time, we are going to be, or 3 weeks' time, I should say, we're going to be bringing you the culmination of Marvel's phase, of the MCU's phase one, as we take a look at Marvel's The Avengers in Hard Travelers for Hire, an episode that will be broadcast live on location. I can reveal that now. Live on location in Orlando, Florida, with other Place to Be Nation pop luminaries, Todd Weber and Russell Sellers, and making his hard-traveling fanboys debut, the esteemed Andrew Chandler Frazier Garner, as we all sit in a room together and watch The Avengers.
It's going to be riveting audio, ladies and gentlemen. We're all going to be full of energy during our WrestleMania trip. It's going to be fun. There's going to be JR-isms. There may even be an appearance from famed French actor Gérard Depardieu.
Gérard Depardieu, not seen since the fantasy comics draft.
And there may even be an appearance from Tim Capel and Todd Weber's own favorite X-Men character, Angus MacWhirter.
Angus MacWhirter.
So
I wonder if there will be guitar interludes.
We can only hope and imagine. But, ladies and gentlemen, that's at another time. We hope you've enjoyed our show. We hope you got through our really long read and watch and our really long X-Men Origins Wolverine talk and our brief rundown. And hope you enjoyed the show. Stay tuned next week. Stay tuned every week. Go read some comics. Go to your local cinemas if you haven't yet and watch Logan. It's worth your time. Catch you next time, folks.
Absolutely. I feel so alone.